How easy was social engineering back then, like calling them up and like talking them into stuff, like what most phone freakers do today?
Well, there was one guy that was doing it in the 30s, and what he was telling me about, they had a tone, 1,000 cycles modulated by 20, so kind of a sound, and that would ring through to operators. It was sort of roughly equivalent to 2600, you know, 30 years later.
Right.
But he could use that, and so when he got a call from one of these operators that connected to an operator to an operator to an operator, you know, three or four, he could do that tone, and they wouldn't, the local operator, his last operator wouldn't see him hung up, but the next operator would see an incoming call, so it would look like an inward call, and you could actually say you were, you know, Seattle, and you want a circuit to Philadelphia or something, or on to Chicago. And so you could pretend like you were an operator. You had to use a woman's voice back then.
Wow. That's like the first op I've heard.
Yeah. And that's so once they caught this guy somehow, and they were tracing him, and he was all worried. It took a couple hours to trace calls back then, and they had his line held up at the local end. So what he did a capacitor phone. In other words, you could actually talk into the phone while it looked to the operator while it was on hook by going through an amplifier and a capacitor.
Right.
Similar to the way mute boxes were later made 30 years later. So he said to the operator, who would normally think it wasn't a customer since it was on hook, "All right, this is test boy, this is tech. You got it held, operator?" "Yes, I sure do. Keep it held for just another minute or so while we do a final trace. Keep it held tight." "Yes, sir." And then, "Okay, we got it now. You can release it, operator."
Oh, wow.
And she did. So he was, you know, an operator would think sure he was a technician with it being on the hook. So he got away before they got it half traced.
Wow.
Well, that is very interesting. So what would be the point of doing this? You said a long distance call would cost about $5 for 3 minutes.
At least. Yeah, maybe to across country might even be more.
So my next question was, is that a flat rate or is it depending on where you're calling?
Where you're calling and also the time of day. There was, I know it would go down at 6 o'clock and come back at 4:30, but I think that was even later. But yeah, there was 6 and 4:30. But yeah, they were still very expensive, and so he was able to make these long-distance calls for free by pretending he was an operator, and this tone, 1,020, would be able to ring other operators.
Well, a few more questions I have. Firstly, you did say that if you were to, you'd have to get onto the long-distance network, first of all, blow the 1,020 over the line to get an operator. But you said that it wouldn't show that you hung up to your local op. She would still see you as being on the phone.
Yeah, but see, the only supervision for long distance was 1,020, and the local just used the on-hook. So as long as he didn't hang up, the local operator saw nothing.
Well, then wouldn't you still be getting billed for the initial long-distance call?
No, because the other operator had rung off. The originating party had hung up. Yeah, so that was
right.
The operator that was doing the ticketing.
Right. Back then they had, like, switchboards, right?
Yeah, and there was like three or four or more involved in one call.
Right.
And they would do the billing by manually jotting down on a piece of paper who was calling where?
Yeah, something like an IBM Hollerith card thing. They had a clock stamped and these little bubbles that they would bubble in, you know, with a certain kind of lead pencil.
Wow.
A Bell system pencil, no less.
Oh, that, of course.
That's back with step-by-step switching.
Yeah, and a lot of places didn't have even step-by-step. It was manual with just the phone you picked up. But
now, whenever you were making a long-distance call, let's say from New York to California, would there be any loss in quality? Would it be really hard to hear the person on the other end?
Yeah, because they would even adjust circuits and everything. It would take a while. Sometimes they would, you know, get everything hooked together, you know, because it might take three or four operators, you know, back in the 30s and stuff.
Right.
By the time of the
50s,
go ahead.
Sorry. Did you have to pay for the operators to connect the call, or did you just pay once you get connected?
Once it all answered.
Wow.
Okay.
And so it might take them, you know, a couple hours to work on it, but once they got it set up, you know, you would pay for the 3-minute call if you just talked 3 minutes.
Now, with so many operators and so many switchboards being involved in hooking a call up cross country, where a dropped call is a problem, where the operator would accidentally pull a plug out of her switchboard and disconnect someone?
Not usually. Operators were just extremely precise and everything. They even had their book of proper phrases. I mean, they didn't say, "Oh, I'll try it. I'll keep trying, and maybe call you when I can." You had to say, "That number doesn't answer now. I'll keep trying and call you."
Wow.
You know, or something like that, or shall I keep trying, or would you like to place your call again? You know, and everything was like phrases, and they had these phonetics, like when they spelled the word, they always spelled it with Alfred, Benjamin, Charles, David, you know,
right.
A is an Alfred.
Call.
You couldn't say A is an apple, you had to say A is an Alfred.
You mean like whenever phone numbers had letters and numbers in them?
Or names, or names of cities, or anything they needed to spell.
Nice.
Yeah, the phone was, you know, but the amazing thing, the dial phones in the 20s, our dial phones now would still work on those. They were a touch tone. You'd still be able to get incoming calls, you know, because the voltages and everything were the same. You know, it would still ring them, you know.
Were there such thing as toll-free numbers back in the 1950s?
Yeah, they were you didn't dial them, you did them through the operator. And they began with either WX or Commerce or Zenith. Like you might have for this stockbroker call Zenith 9100. You know, so you'd call the operator and she would look in her multi-leaf bulletin, her book where the routings and all that is recorded, and she would find a conversion number for this Zenith 9100, and it would go through, and the class of it would be called Special Collect. That's what she'd mark on that ticket you were talking about, the card. They call them tickets.
Right.
And so she would mark Special Collect on the ticket, and the people contracting this for this service would be, they would automatically accept charges. In other words, all calls came in, it would be assumed to be accepting charges.
Now, back then, what type of like phreaking did you guys do? Like with the, because like now, I mean, our systems are so advanced now that there are so many ways that you can, you know, phreak the telco. But like, you mentioned OptiVerde, but like, what were some of the other ways that you guys did back then?
You could whistle single frequency tones of 2600. So like, if you, well, like in 1961 or 62, let's say, when they had directory assistance dialing with the 555-1212, it was free back then.
Right.
So if you wanted Cincinnati, you might dial 555-1212, and some of those trunks weren't EMF. You'd find one that wasn't, you know, it was dial pulse, and you'd go like, you know, 2600 to cut it off, and then for 6, for 2, and for 9, like that.
Are you whistling that?
Yeah,
2600.
That's nice.
Yeah,
I'm impressed.
That's
nice. Yeah, so that's how you'd actually make a call. Of course, they did have the blue box tones too, but they had 26. Then you also had to know if you heard the circuit sounding different. Oh, this is the 1600. See, there was 1600 before 2600, because during the war, a lot of the bandwidth of the circuits was kind of narrow.
Right.
Because they cut circuits in half. They needed capacity so bad. They had these real, you know, constricted bandwidths. And, well, maybe it wasn't quite that bad, but almost. But, so they used 1600 instead of 26. So then you'd go, you know, like that.
Right.
In a lower tone. But those, you know, they started going out pretty rapidly in the 60s, but I found one or two, like in 68, that still used 1600. And they were, they used old vacuum tube, huge pieces of equipment to, you know, detect those tones and everything.
Wow. How were the vacuum tubes able to discern what tones they were?
They had big coils, inductors, and capacitors as, like, bandpass filters and stuff like that. Discriminator circuits were some of the things they used to detect tones. And they were, you know, took a lot of big parts, but, you know, big coils, but it was, they worked really well. The
Wow.
You know, the 2600 filters were pretty tight and everything.
I have a question relating to the older 1950s technology. He says used approximately 1,020 hertz for signaling.
Yeah, way back to the 30s.
Since it is such a low tone, would it be possible for that to be topped off rather easily?
Well, it had to be modulated by 20 hertz, so and you had to hold it for a little bit, too. So between the unique combination and then having to hold it to get it to start ringing, and even then, it wouldn't automatically talk you off. The operator would see the light come in her proper phrase for that. You didn't dare do it wrong. It's, are you through? Are you through?
Voice like that?
Yeah, that's the way she usually said it. She'd open her talk key when she saw the ringing, you know, the light responding to the ringing, and she'd say, are you through? Are you through?
And that's to make sure that there isn't still a conversation going on.
Yeah. And then if there was, she'd say sorry or something, or, you know, presumably, or maybe you got cut off and she'd reconnect the call, or the phone ring off or something, but she'd make sure, or if she didn't hear anything, she would disconnect them.
Wow.
A lot of times before disconnecting, she'd say, like, Miami off.
Nice.
You know, if it was Miami or Seattle off, you know, Boston off.
Right. Now, did you guys have, like, any ways to talk to each other? Like, you know, aside from just calling each other, could you guys call, like, conference, like, loop lines or conferences or anything?
Not until the late 60s. That's when we sort of found out about those. In the 50s, we didn't, although some people that did have loops were homemade ones. The bookies in Miami, they were called cheese boxes. And the blue box was named from bookies, and the black box, when they found these, because they were the color of the box or something that the first one that the prosecutors had happened to be. But the cheese box, the bookies would be taking bets, and they would have the number that you called to take the bets in some kind of warehouse, and another line there, and they'd be coupled together. They'd rent two business lines. And then one person would be called on one line, and it would automatically answer and connect to the other, and it would trip in anytime the person placing the bets called in. So once the telephone company traced the calls, they would have this big raid, bunches of policemen would come, and they'd end up finding an empty warehouse or something way out with two phones in it, nobody there.
And then after that happens, the bookies would probably become aware of this because of they're watching over the place and simply stop using that.
Yeah, and of course, after a while, too, the prosecutors got wise to the use of cheese boxes. But so then they started making them so they couldn't be found as easy. They made it so if only one person was dialed into the numbers, it would just ring. They wouldn't trip out automatically until both callers were on there, the little more advanced cheese box circuit.
And the course of cheese box is a present such to the more common gold box found nowadays. Another question I had, I forget what this one was. I'll come back to that later.
Okay.
But yeah, there was, that's about 1948 or so is when the blue box tones first started coming into the network, the multi-frequency pulsing.
You said 1948?
Yeah.
I had no idea. Was that early on?
Well, for the actual blue box to work?
Yeah. The MF tones were first starting to be used.
Well, who developed the first blue box back then? Like, that could actually generate that?
Yeah, I don't know, because I figured out the tones in about 1957 by ear.
Wow.
You know, I had the operator, you know, she was pushing buttons on the board instead of dialing. And I knew that they had to be some kind of way, you know, of dialing. And then I had her to dial a number with all zeros and a number with ones, and it went through the same speed.
Right.
And I said, there's something different than rotary dial going on here.
Wow.
And I had the operator to push her buttons, and I said, what do you do, you know, if you were dialing them towards me, because I couldn't hear them, and she said, well, there's a KP back, and I had her to push that, and I still wouldn't hear the tones. And I thought, maybe this line is still on the hook. I need to go on the hook, so I did a capacitor phone into my old Webcore tape recorder.
Right.
And had her to push, and suddenly those tones just about busted the speaker. They were so loud.
Wow.
And so I had her to push 1 through 9, and I said, what else do you put, or 1 through 0, and I said, what else, when you dial a more buttons than that. Oh, yeah, we have to push our KP and then our little start at the end. I said, push those, and she did. So then I played the tape over and over and listened by ear.
Right.
And I said, oh, this isn't just one tone. These are two together. And this one, oh, yeah, like the one and the two has one tone in common. So gradually I figured out the tones. And I said, I don't know what the real tones are, but I'll round them off to even hundreds. Like, I'll call this first one in the one 700.
Right.
It turned out it was exactly 700, but
right.
I just, for all I knew, it could have been 706 or something. But, you know, but it was actually, so I got all the tones by ear, and it took me several hours.
Wow, and that was back in the 50s?
Yeah.
Because I think the first documented use, like the ones that was actually publicized, was back with like Wozniak and with John Draper, Captain Crunch there, you know. And then for when was that? That was, I think, in the 60s.
Yeah, like maybe 68 or something. I don't know, but I had them in the 50s, but I didn't know at that time
that's what
how to use them for free calls. I knew that that's what the operators used,
right.
And then I realized that's what the network used. But it was like about 8 or so years later that I actually put it together and said, oh, if I send those, I could dial them. I wonder how it would bill. And I said, I guess it would only bill me for directory. So I recorded those tones, you know, artificially made them, and realized, you know, that I could make calls that way too.
Right. No, that's nice though, because like I knew the technology was the same back then. You know, like even with the blue boxes, but that was the only recorded like history of blue boxes, you know, of the tones being used. You know,
yeah,
and for
so
you to
I
be
had
doing it that early, you know, just you know, my theory is just proven correct, that's all.
Yeah, so I had them before I even knew what they were called. I didn't know, so I just called them operator tones.
Yeah.
Although they were used in automatic switching systems too, they really weren't only operator tones, but that's what I called them when I was 8 or 9 years old and figuring them out by ear, you know.
Wow, and that's 8 or 9. That's nice. We got a lot in common.
Yeah, I guess you just get into, like, you're getting to computers, you know,
yeah.
And you're kind of, that's the best way to get good at them is to be
yeah.
onto them when, you know, you're little and smarter than when you get to be 89 years old, you know.
Yeah, no, that's when I started out in phones. I started out, like, right around when I was 9 years old talking to operators. Yeah, you know, so that's why I said we got something in common.
At least when you were pretending you were an operator, you didn't have to be a woman then like you did in the 50s.
Oh, no. I mean, gosh, the women were great. They would just tell me anything, you know. They'd tell me about how the system works, you know, like how everything got switched around. And when I was a kid, you know, I thought it was just a phone, you know.
Yeah, back in the 50s, I only had women operators. So if you weren't, you know, if you had a man's voice, you had to be a technician or something.
Yeah. Well, what were the technicians called back then? Did they have, like, special names?
I would say usually, you know, it's Joe Edwards from San Fran Toll Task or the four-wire board or something. Operators didn't always know the names, or sometimes I'd say from Long Lines, or sometimes I'd say Bell Labs were conducting
nice.
Special equipment surveys.
Wow.
And she said, oh, Bell Labs, yeah, we get a Bell Lab magazine here, you know. And, wow, somebody right up at the laboratories, where are you? And I said, oh, New Jersey, and Homedale, oh, yes, and, you know, or something. And
they'd be BSing you.
Yeah, and I'd say, now, you know, it looks like, and I said, the interesting thing for you, though, you would never believe me if I told you I was actually in New Jersey, because it looks like I'm coming in from the Jackson Exchange in Fort Lauderdale, probably. At least that's what it's supposed to look like. Yeah, it does. I mean, you're not coming from, it doesn't look like you're coming from New Jersey. I said, yeah, see, we have control of the network. And, you know, you could call me back in New Jersey if you wanted to. And, you know, wow, that's amazing.
Nice.
Actually, I was really in South Florida. But,
mm-hmm. I remember my question, though. I wanted to ask you, whenever back in the 50s again, whenever they actually did have to patch you through at switchboard level, would it be possible to send things like voltage spikes, and would they travel all the way through to the other end?
You mean like dial pulsing or something like that? Or?
Oh, well, let's say you wanted to be malicious and fry a person's phone, and you like just plug your phone into the electrical outlet. Would that current travel all the way there? Or would these
no,
things
the,
unintentionally?
it probably wouldn't even get past the mainframe at your local central office, because they had carbons and heat coils. So heat coils, like coils that would blow for current, and the carbons would arc over and get destroyed for voltage. But then along the way, there was all kinds of repeat coils. You were only inductively connected to the network.
Okay.
So you would never be able to get the spike through there.
Wow.
You would be able to get awfully loud tones, though, on some circuits. For instance, the old howler was 10 steps of loudness, and it'd get really loud then, and it was kind of a steady, kind of distorted tone, and I did the wrong pitch, but anyway, I can't do it as low as it was. It was 460 hertz, but that 10th step was so loud that now it would violate safety standards and stuff.
Well, can tones that loud even be played over the current phone system as it stands?
No. It was like plus 40 VU, and in the 302 type phones, the type before the current, what was the current ones, you know, in the 60s and stuff, the 500 type, the 302s didn't have as much compression as the 500s, so that 40 VU would be tremendously loud. We had, in Massachusetts, we had the phone number 82826, we left an extension off the hook, and the operator plugged it into that howler, and we were downstairs, we were hearing something real loud upstairs. We couldn't tell quite what it was with the TV on, the old Dumont that we had on, and finally Daddy walked around the house and found that it was a phone. We were hearing it real loud from upstairs.
So that's what they use it for, to let you know your phone was off the hook?
Yeah.
That's cool.
It was loud. And then they developed this new one. They had a group at Bell Labs that people commonly called it the Grouch Group, because they were supposed to, develop a horrible-sounding tone, but yet it wouldn't overload. It was actually called the Task Force to Optimize the Alertability of the Receiver Off-Hook Tone, which is a little mouthful, but they came up with a tone they use now. It's four tones simultaneously, 1400, 2060, 2450, and 2600. 2600 is in there. Yeah, it's on, tones simultaneously on for 100 milliseconds with 100 millisecond silence in between.
Wow.
And that's the current howler standard.
So that's the one you still hear to this day when your phone is off the hook.
Yeah, and it's set maybe at about a 0 dBm or something like that, or minus 2, or,
right.
You know, nothing compared to the loudness of the highest step in that old one.
Wow. That's
I mean, you could hold those old 302 phones in your hand when that thing was going on, and it'd vibrate against you. You could put it against your chest, and it'd vibrate your body.
Oh, my. Didn't they have any laws covering over in that back then? Because obviously it would have had to, like, kill your eardrums.
Yeah, I think it would. I don't know if they had any laws, but they sure did later, and that was one reason they had to do away. They took off, didn't have a howler much for a while. They didn't put that one in automatic systems. And
I mean, that would just be monstrous for today.
It was. Yeah, you would believe, but I mean, you'd have to have felt it against your chest to really.
I can just imagine. I mean, back then, oh man, that must have been monstrous.
Yeah, Mother thought it was neat when I massaged her sore feet with the phone one day. I also made a phone call to San Francisco through Mother's bra. Yeah, I was in Miami at the time, she had this strapless bra. And it had an underwire, and at that time they were made of metal, and I opened the ring side of the line, the red wire, and one alligator clip I put on the underwire and hooked to one side of the ring, and the other side I hooked to the other side of the ring, so in effect the underwire of Mother's bra was in series with the line.
Right.
And she came in to get her bra to put it on, and I said, well, let me finish this call to San Francisco,
Nice. And you were able to call for free when you did that?
Well, that wasn't because of the bra, but yeah, the free was because I think I was talking. Yeah, that's right. It was like a free loop around or something. I don't remember exactly the way the call was free, but that had nothing to do with the bra. It was just a connection.
Right. Nice.
Now, The thing that I never quite understood when I read files about the old phone systems is how they say that some numbers don't supervise, like the loop lines, for instance. I'm under the impression, as the current phone system is, that supervision isn't decided on the end of the number, but actually your local switch decides that. Is that true, and how's it set up in the past?
Yeah, well, it could be decided in the switches now. It definitely could be decided at the destination number, just like in the old days, except, of course, it would be a different way.
Right.
For instance, in the old step-by-step, they had in the rotary, or the, rotary hunt connectors, you could bend these little things called normal post springs in the connector circuit, and they would make it on-hook supervision. They would generally be used for, like, telephone company numbers and stuff. And quite often they were bent in the local connectors only, so in effect you would have the supervision from the local area only, like for payphones.
Right.
But they could be made, and once they combined the trains and stuff, they were non-super long distance. Then in 1A ESS, or 1 ESS, like the first one of which went into Sukasana in 1965, you'd actually type in FRE in one of the message setting up that number
right. As
a feature, and that would make it free incoming for that number.
Right.
But the loops were done differently. They were a trunk circuit, so that you program those in so the number, the root index, which is what pointed a number to a trunk and stuff, those would be free. But it was done at the, you know, the destination, you know, where that telephone number was.
Another question about that. Now, you said that by entering the code FRE, you'll make the call able to receive free incoming calls.
Yeah.
Is that similar to an 800 number where the call would be billed to the subscriber, or would it be just totally free?
They would just not give off-hook supervision. So, in effect, it would be like a no answer.
Oh,
that's a really weird way of doing it.
That's inside the switch itself?
Yeah. It's like number 5 crossbar. You could actually have a free ring combination in the number group frame where you wired in the numbers, you know, where you put a number connecting it to a line location. In other words, you'd actually point a telephone number to the actual piece of line equipment and have to go through and stuff. And it was a big field, huge bunch of wire-wrapped wires cross-connected.
Wow.
Tons of them, just thousands. And you could actually make a number free over there at that frame.
Now, is it relatively easy to talk switch operators into going ahead and making a number free for you if it already wasn't?
Probably not a regular number, but a loop around or something that was already a test number could be done. And then the other problem, a lot of loops back then had filters that filtered out voice, so you had to have them set the switch. Yeah, we're doing, want to change the parameters, we're doing some different transmission tests. If you could change the switch setting on the loop from norm to LCT. Well, let me see. I don't know if there's a switch. Oh, yeah, here it is. Yeah, there's a norm. Yeah, it's on norm now. And then if you could just switch it to LCT, that's all we need done. Oh, okay. Yeah, done that. And, you know, I hope you don't want anything else. I'm kind of busy. No, that'll do it. You know, and it would
mean it stays like that for 7 months afterwards.
Yeah.
Nice. Boy, it sounds like they're really easy to social back then.
Yeah, and some people would call loops collect, too.
Yeah.
Of course, that was bad because you'd get a bill later and they'd take the thing out or change the number, but one party would be on there and the other party would call it collect. There was no, like, restrict collect on numbers back then.
Well, that actually brings me to another point. You said there was payphones in this early system. What would then prevent someone from calling a payphone collect?
It was interesting. The operators, whenever you made a collect call, they'd call directory assistance in that city and say, checking for coin 661-9963. And the operators say, that is a coin, TX36. And what that would mean is, yes, it's a coin phone, and the operator handling the ticketing on that at the destination end, you'd dial the routing codes plus 1136.
That's right. I heard that before.
Yeah, so that operator would do the ticketing and the collect. You couldn't collect coins over long-distance circuits, so you'd actually get an operator in Miami if you were in Boston, let's say. and call and collect the coin, you'd actually have to have the operator in Miami do the ticketing on it.
Right.
Now, would they actually complete collect calls the coin if they put in your money?
Back then, yeah, the operator had to stay on and, you know, listen for the money, you know, the, you know, ding for the nickel and ding ding for the dime and ball for the quarter.
I'm actually really, really surprised that they would even allow that.
Yeah.
Were the rates for a collect call, I imagine they were astronomical?
Yeah, well, of course, you'd have to put in the money before you started talking, I think, for the initial 3 minutes.
Wow.
And coin phones are probably cheaper than they are now, because back then, they weren't that much more than the operator-assisted calls. You know, they've just gone up a lot since then, but I don't think they even allow collect-a-coin anymore.
No, they certainly don't.
No, definitely not.
Not that they've allowed that for many, many years.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this was like in the 60s, for instance, that you could still do it. I don't know how late into the, whether it was the 70s or what, when they stopped allowing it, but I remember hearing something that they did. But yeah, they used to go through a lot of trouble to make those. They were always kind of a you know, you'd have to get that local operator to ticket it. And directory assistants in any city had all the records. They generally put the coins in 9. So in your routing information, if you were looking at that exchange, like let's say you were calling a number in Miami beginning with 305-661, the old Mohawk exchange,
right.
You'd look at it and say check 9 for coin and have a 9 in that column. Whereas I think in Franklin 4 they had 8 and 9, and the numbers beginning with 8s and 9s because they maybe didn't have enough 9s or something. They had some coin phones beginning with 8, but they tell you what to check. So if the number had a Franklin 4 and then an 8 after it, you'd call directory and say that checking for coin, Franklin 4, 8033.
Right.
Not a coin, you know, and if she said not a coin, then you were okay.
Right.
So I assume that even if you were to check a non-existent number, it would come up as not a coin, because they only have a directory of the coin numbers.
Well, some of them did it by 100 groups. The coins were put in the 100 groups, so they'd probably say it was a coin. You know, if they had like the 8200 through 8499 as coin, if they did it that way, then everything would come up as coin.
Right.
But once you called it, you get a disconnected number. But that at least gave you the opportunity to hear the, them get the local operator on the line, you know, in Miami, and you'd get to hear some of the procedures until they actually called the number. But at least you'd get to hear them, you know, checking with directory and saying that is a coin. So it was a free way of getting that far to hear that part of the operator procedure.
Wow.
Just by calling an intercepted number.
Right. Now, is there a way that you could duplicate the sound that the money made when it went into the phone back then as you can now?
Well, on the old cord boards, the problem is they had a light that would tell if at least one coin was put in. It actually...
So,
a coin light, it had to do with the ground on the tip of the line.
Right, so it was an actual physical switch inside the phone to receive the coin.
It would ground, any time you put the coins in the coin phone, it would ground it anyway.
Right.
And this light in the on the switchboard, you know, the coin circuit did show whether it was grounded or not. So if you put in a real nickel, then if you had a good enough acoustic coupler, you could, you know, probably do it.
Right. Wow. So you mean like if you put in a nickel into the payphone first and then just do it, you know, after that, then you could possibly get away with it.
Yeah. If the operator's ears were pretty sharp, and tape recorders, you know, you didn't really readily have tape recorders, and people have tried to bring these brass bells from some elephant, you know, deal or something, you know, was the operator would know the sound, you know, it was a different bell. Somebody tried to use some wedding brass bell that they got or some banging, you know.
Wow.
If you connected a paper clip to the microphone and grounded it, would that allow you to make a call?
Yeah, they didn't have battery recorders back then, you know, in the 50s when I was trying to do it, so.
Wow.
You know, but if you had... Yeah, if you had a way of bringing that 40-pound Webcore tape recorder down there and hooking
and,
it up.
And not being seen.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But, well, there was some payphones way far out on the road, but you'd have to have an inverter in your car, maybe, for the electricity.
Oh, gosh.
So with those 6 volts.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Back then, the car batteries were 6 volts, so it'd drive up pretty hard with an inverter.
Nice.
You said the payphones used reverse polarity. Is there a way you could ground that, say, from the microphone to the chassis of the phone?
Yeah, and back then, a lot of them didn't have the mics glued or really tight like they did later with the tool needed to get the cap off. But yeah, you could, there was some you could even stick a pin in there and then ground it with alligator clips. But if you didn't do it carefully, you'd damage the diaphragm of the mic and it'd make the transmission cruddy. So the art of it was to stick the pin in just the part of the mouthpiece where you wouldn't hurt the diaphragm and still be able to ground it.
Right.
But then later they started needing something like a long kind of a jar opener like thing with rubber that you squeezed around the receiver cap. It was like a foot and a half long or something, and like pliers.
Oh, geez.
To turn that mouthpiece cap because they were on extremely tight.
Now, was that to keep the theft of the mics down, or?
Yeah, I think grounding both. Yeah, that would work. Well, mostly the theft of the mic, but the people that. There was more of the theft of those that knew how to ground it, but either it helped both things.
Right.
And then they put in a metal a mouthpiece of a coin phone was different than the regular phones. It didn't have the little holes in it, so you couldn't get the pin down into the diaphragm back down through there to ground it with.
Right. That's
and then they had the different cords to the metal cords on the payphone, because so many people were cutting into the cord to get the ground. You could ground the mouthpiece wire. It was the red or black. You could ground the red or black wire as opposed to the two whites, which at that time was for the earpiece. I think now they have green and white, or they did later. But anyway, it was the red and black where the mouthpiece wires, you had to ground one of those.
That's all pretty interesting. So when did blue boxing first take off?
I guess in the late 60s, because, you know, I knew the tones in the 50s, but I think it wasn't until, like, about 64 that I made my calls. There were some people using them in the 50s. I think the bookies used them pretty early, too. I don't know. But there was very few, and they really had it hush-hush, the few people that used it in the 50s, you know.
I imagine they would keep it secret, something that powerful, you know. Now, whenever people first started using this for the free calls, were they aware that you can do other things with it?
Like what?
Like the N-words and the verification circuits and stuff like that?
I don't know. I know, you know, they used to do some of that. Of course, another way, if you didn't know the automatic verification numbers, you could just have the operator on the cord board plug you in and, you know, what would you like me to dial something? Oh, no, we're the test board. We can actually control your board from here. Oh, you can. You can dial on my board from there. Wow, you must have, sophisticated equipment. So she'd really believe us, you know, and then she'd see the light go off and everything. And that's amazing. You can take control of my board like that.
Well, actually, exactly how did verification work? Because the few files I read, I don't really believe that the way it was explained to me.
There was a few different ways. The main kind and the original on the cord board, they would plug into a verify trunk and dial either like the last few digits of the number if it was, you know, dedicated to that exchange, or sometimes 7 digits. And that worked fine for the cord board. But when they went to TSPS, they had to put in a code that they would dial first, and the 4A toll, let's say, would connect them to the verify trunks.
So the information I read, which I do believe is inaccurate, said that once you seized the trunk via a blue box, you simply typed in a certain code followed by the phone number you wanted to listen to. Was there anything like that that existed back in that time?
Yeah, for a while, like in Miami, this is long gone, so I could talk about it, but it was like 600 and a 7-digit number. And they were supposed to be blocked from blue box trunks, non-operator trunks. You never should have been able to get them. But through errors in the class of service, you'd be able to get through. We never should have been able to use those, but because normally they should have been classed, and were supposed to be classed, so only the operator board TSPS trunks would be allowed to even reach those.
Well, firstly, I was under the impression that using a blue box, you had the same power as an operator. If
when you say I got a call waiting?
I was under the impression using a blue box you had the exact same privileges as an operator and there wasn't nothing other they could do.
Yeah, if it was a code that other people wouldn't need to dial from, like, out of town or something, they could, you know, in certain cases like the Verify, they could make it only be dialed from the TSPS group, but things like Inward and stuff had to be dialable from all over, so the blue boxes had to be able to reach that. There was no, virtually no way. Well, actually, they could have classed it so that Inwards couldn't be reached from, like, these, like your local trunks from your home central office and stuff. But that, you know, that all took electromechanical relays and complicated cross-connect wiring, and they could only do so much class of service anyway.
And it was probably really expensive for the phone company to put in these limitations when they probably felt they weren't necessary.
Yeah, and for Inward. But they did try to do it for Verify, but quite often they got it wrong.
So with this particular area, all you'd have to do is box into the switch to control the local area, send your KP600 seven-digit number start, and that was it?
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah, you know, listen in on, you know.
Besides listening, were you also able to talk over the line and interrupt calls in progress?
Yeah.
Oh, my. That's like the ultimate remob.
Yeah, it makes me wish that I still lived in a time where that was possible.
Yeah, back then they weren't scrambled either. Later they had scramblers using a 1700 cycle inversion frequency and everything. I had fun decoding that through a sideband balance modulator.
Oh, so the scramblers of back then were actually decodable?
Yeah, with what they call speech inversion. It was about 1700 hertz. And you mix that in with the balance modulator thing and four diodes, and I alligator clipped them together. I had wires all over the place. And
I wonder if the current stuff, the DAT2 scramblers, are decodable.
I have the slightest idea. But you can actually put a ring forward on the line, a short on hook,
right.
And it would open up the defeat the scrambler, but they would get a loud, like a 2 second beep of 440 hertz on the line.
Well, that's the operator intercept, right?
Is that still today? You can still do that today?
The scramblers may be different, but you could still, you know, an operator could, I think, but now the verification is very, you know, it shows up on the console, especially if you do it without a customer on the line and everything. There's a lot of safeguards built in.
Nice.
Now, back then, I remember reading an article, a really old article, saying how somebody was able to verify a government number and actually speak with the President Nixon. By finding a toll-free number that was a CIA crisis hotline, and then finding what number that mapped to and verifying that particular number. Was that something like that possible, and do you know if this was ever actually done, or was this just some kind of fictitious story that's been floating around?
I don't know if it was actually done or not. I suspect it was, because it's completely technically possible, and whether the guy actually in truth did it or not, but it would be reasonably straightforward to do with, I mean, you shouldn't have been able to do it. For one thing, the Verify codes should never have been accessible, but, well, actually, even if they weren't, you could have called, let's say, Washington Inward at that time, and they could have plugged you into on the cord board to the Verify trunks, and you could have MF'd it from there.
Right.
And dialed right through, just told the operator, close their talk key, and you're going to take control over board. This is a test. And, you know,
I wish you could do that today.
Yeah. I know one told me, I don't think I better dial anything for you on these verification trunks. Oh, no, operator, you don't need to dial anything. We're just going to do a test, you know, without, yeah, you won't have to dial anything. Oh, that's all right, then just leave my cord plugged in. Yeah, and then unplug it, you know, when you see me unplugged. Okay.
Wow.
That is so insane. Now, wasn't there any kind of security for numbers that were zoned as being government use only?
If they had a Centrex, you know, a separate step Centrex,
yeah.
It was harder to verify. You had to go through the Centrex operator and get them to override it from the console. And you couldn't verify it in normal verification trunks because they didn't go off on the central office line, you know, that. So, yeah, that made it harder. But if they were regular straightforward central office government lines like the FBI numbers or something like that. You could just get in them because they were just ordinary numbers of the White House, you know, stuff.
Right.
So basically, the phone system of the 1960s and probably the 70s as well was totally wide open, and anybody who knew what they were doing would be able to basically tap any phone line in the U.S.
Yeah, I guess with the cordboard method, I guess you could have, because the operator, you know, if you had it plugged in on verified trunks, although it would sure make a loud clunk when it went in on top of somebody, but, you know, people a lot of times wouldn't notice there was so many noises and stuff.
Especially if it was a long-distance call.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, although the noise would increase, you know, on long distance, they'd hear long distance noise. If they were on a local and you came in, they'd hear a shh. So if you were skilled, you'd sure notice it. It was, you know, but, you know, it could be done.
That's very, very scary. What other cool things could be done? What other codes existed that you can type in?
And they had numbers you could dial the service of their, like the business office, to listen in and see what they were doing. And some that I never had, they had microphones you could dial into.
Oh, like monitors.
Yeah, monitors for like the commercial office and see what the reps were talking among themselves.
Nice.
And there were special service observers that would dial in and, you know, if a lady was, you know, they would know what you were talking about or something, or how you talked to the customer coming in over the counter. There was actually these monitor mics there, you know, you would trip in.
That's kind of spooky, huh? I imagine much later on there was laws in place to prevent people from spying on their employees like that.
I hope so.
Yeah, probably.
I don't know. But yeah, there was a lot of that. Even in the 40s, they had these numbers that there was one I know you had to let it ring like 10 rings, and then it would answer. And you would just hear the mic right, you know, open.
Sort of like the elevator numbers of today, but a little more discreet.
Yeah.
I read an article once that said that a few number of skilled freaks with blue boxes would theoretically be able to take down links between two cities by stacking the tandems up. Is there any truth behind that, and how would one go about doing that?
That would be pretty hard. You could, because there's so much alternate routing, but you could dial numbers that would give you a wink from a distant system and come back through and, you know, you could do some damage, but they could, you know, it'd be pretty easy for them to knock down the trunks and release them and stuff. And,
well, assuming they saw all the connections in progress, but later on, like in the late 60s or 70s, whenever things were a little more automated, wouldn't it theoretically be possible, let's say, to see the trunk, dial into to New York, and then from New York to California, California back to New York, and continue to stack those up, to the point where you can't pass tones over anymore because the line is already in use, and then simply leave that phone off, hope to move to another phone and continue the process.
And yeah.
Theoretically be able to knock down every single link between those two cities.
In some cases, it would be very hard because finding those kind of access numbers, there wasn't many ways of doing that. But, well, you could whistle. Yeah, you could actually whistle the 2600 and put another tone over it. That would,
it would not
be louder if you're originating in one that
right.
Would go through the circuit.
I think the proper term for that is pink noise.
Maybe so it'd be, you'd have a tone over the 26 up near like 3,000 or 3,200 on the fringe, kind of. And it would be very difficult. It theoretically might be able to be done.
Yeah, I think I've read how that's called pink noise and was originally used to defeat blue box detectors. Is there any truth behind that?
Probably. I never actually did that, but I don't know with the 2600 detector on the line, I don't know if that would make it not detect or not.
I was told that modern-day blue boxing via calling a third world country using a toll-free number, that if you were to blow just the 26 and the 2624 required to seize a trunk in that distant country, you would be immediately disconnected from your phone number because there is a blue box detector here on the local switch of the U.S. And I was told by that same person, if you mix another frequency that's above 3,000 to the mix, the tone will reach a distant country and you won't be disconnected by the U.S. So that's why I'm thinking that was possible back then as well.
It might be. I haven't played with the blue box detector for the 24 and 26. I heard a guy from the Netherlands doing that, dialing numbers that went through the U.S. on to, like, Brazil or something, and then doing it. They had it on Radio Netherlands a little bit about it, but several years back.
I wouldn't mind listening to that particular radio show.
Yeah, you might call, I don't know if they have any archives, but Radio Netherlands, you might search back for the Phone Freak. I think it might have been on the Media Network program, maybe back in the...
We might have to rebroadcast a portion of that if we find anything interesting.
Yeah, mid-90s maybe or something, and it was supposedly not really illegal in Holland, or they couldn't... He said they couldn't prosecute him for it or something. And,
yeah, it's legal over there.
Yeah, and so it was actually on shortwave, so I don't even remember what year it was.
It's probably really hard to track down, but I would love to hear that.
Yeah,
Media Network would have been the name of the show, which is no longer on, but perhaps they have archives somewhere. It's probably before internet became popular. But
right. Well, maybe it's on text files.
Yeah, everything's on text files.
Yeah, because if some shortwave listener had it recorded or something, and put it in.
That would have been nice.
Yeah.
There's one basic article that I'm really interested in. I'm mostly into remote access and test drones and things like that. What kind of options did technicians have back then to test the line for troubleshoot?
The one kind of remote test line that, like from the test board that Bell used, it actually called you back, so you couldn't really do anything. But there was various types of transmission testing. I guess the main one that outsiders could use was the loop around.
And that was abused very heavily, I would assume.
Yeah.
Speaking of, actually changing the subject back to blue boxing once more, I also read, I've obviously been doing a lot of research on this topic, and by the way, I'm very glad to finally speak with someone knowledgeable in this field, because I have had up to this point a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah, me too. I'm always learning something. I figure the more I learn something new every day, but I just stay a little bit less behind. This field changes so much, you know.
Well, what I read was that this only worked on certain exchanges, but if you simply sent KP plus the area code start, it would actually give you a trunk on that local system. But I also read that same file that it only worked in certain areas. Is there any truth to this? And if so, why did it only work in certain areas?
Certain switches, certain crossbar tandems mainly, it would give you a wink. But that was very rare, the ones that would do it. The KP and the start, the way it would handle that had to be optioned. And it was only in certain crossbar tandems. And I don't know why I didn't delve into... what the difference in classes of service of the registers in the crossbar tandem. It had to do with what they would send. In other words, when they didn't receive any digits, it had to be where they deleted the area code. It was a delete 3 situation. I didn't find out that much. So like when you send a 10-digit number, it would only send like the 7 digits forward. So if you had just dialed the area code, it would have no 7 digits forward. And, you know, 0 digits. And some crossbar tandems in a 0 digit would send KP start, so you'd get a call did not go through and it would fail. But others wouldn't send anything, and I never did get to that last point to find out why.
It sounds to me like a software revision or a configuration revision. So basically what you're saying was you pick up a trunk and you can send KP, let's say for Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 412 start. And the switch in Pittsburgh would get 412, nothing else. And if it was not this particular kind of system, it would try to process a call to 412, fail because it's not a four-digit number, and then give you a reorder. Or it would delete 3, get rid of 412 completely, find there's no number available, and either send you a new prompt in the form of a reorder asking for input, or try to place a call to KP start, which would then also fail.
Yeah, that's why. Well, actually, the KP start is what it would send, and that would fail.
Or that would give you a new.
Or it would send nothing and seize the trunk, in which case you'd have a wink from the distant end.
And this was very rare. See, that's another thing I was always didn't know. Why didn't they either all do that or none of them do that? But I guess
yeah.
No one really knows that.
Yeah, and a crossbar tandem was a two-wire machine, so it was used in smaller cities and. You know, or other kind of the 4A's or 4-wire switching, they were the main switches, and they didn't do it. This only was in the smaller the two-wire crossbar tandem switches that this could happen.
That's pretty neat stuff.
And, yeah, I never did. Probably if I would have had people to analyze the cross-connects or known what to ask or pursued it, I probably could have found it out, but there was like one in Poughkeepsie, New York, I know, that did it.
Well, earlier I had asked you about the theoretical possibility of someone completely blocking two routes from city to city via stacking tandems, and what
yeah,
I was actually referring to...
this to be involved in.
Right, that's what I was referring to, is the particular switches that allow you to KP area code start and get a fresh reorder. And my thinking behind it was you find two of those, one in New York, one in California, and you just keep hopping between the two, each time getting into a wink. I believe I've heard an audio recording on phone trips that describe this exactly, but it really didn't get into the full details as to whether this could be done for a long period of time or whatnot.
Yeah, because it was so limited kinds of circuits that you could do it on and everything. I did it for like 12 or 13 connections or something, and, you know, stuff like that. But
well, also in that particular recording I'm referring to on phone trips, it said that the limitations to that method was that eventually, since you were going such a long distance, the end machine wouldn't be able to hear your box tones anymore because the audio would be so faint. But it
yeah,
also...
even with 12 connections, it was pretty bad. You had to amplify those blue box tones, you know, through a pretty good amplifier.
And the file I was reading also mentioned that there was another way, another method of stacking tandems that would get around that limitation, but the information stopped before it explained the other method. Do you have any idea what it might have been referring to?
Not offhand. Well, maybe it was going to talk about the, what you call the pink noise, the whistling thing.
Possibly.
You know, because let's say you called, if you call something that goes over more than one route, you could whistle the final one off, and then call something through there, and then whistle that final. I don't know how many you could do that way. It would get very touchy.
Yeah, but also the problem with that is, A, you know, might not get the noise right and take yourself off, and B, I see the same problem happening with eventually getting so far in the remote thing can't hear you. And
well, before you even got that far, the pink noise would stop being effective and everything, and I don't think you could get it touchy enough, so that would, you probably wouldn't be able to get as far as you could with the other method, but it would tie up a few circuits. And you need a lot of people, you know, on separate lines, you know, like you were talking about with the, you
right.
know, the winking.
They call them winkies, and that was really cold?
No, winking, in other words, the crossbar tandem, the signal to go ahead and start sending digits is a wink back signal. So you'd get one that was winking, as you put it, it would give you a wink.
Okay.
Well, actually, there was different kinds of starts, too. You might get a delay dial, but they tended to be... it would be like a short off-look and on-look is what it would be, like clunk-clunk. And if you were on an operator board, the light would go off and then on. And once it was on, that would be an indication to your origination machine that it was ready to, you know, that the destination was ready to receive digits.
Oh, so the whenever a call was being boxed, the lights would actually flash on the operator board?
No, this is if the operator, for instance, was plugging in, which, of course, her tones were the blue box tones. She would plug in, and the light would go off momentarily, and then it would come on, and that was, you know, when she was ready to dial. She'd have the equipment.
I understand.
Or if one switch is sending to another, it would actually see an off-look from the distant end, and then an on-look, and once it saw that on-look after the off-look, it would know to start sending the digits.
I also read somewhere about a legendary conference that was reached by boxing to a certain area and then typing, I believe it was either 2112 or was it 1221?
2111 in British Columbia.
That's the one, 2111.
Yeah, area 604.
So you would
I have no idea who they were or what they were in for or anything who put those in.
Would that be reached by sending KP, was it 603, 602 you said?
604.
604-2111, or would you go 604 start and then get a new wink and then do 211?
No, you didn't. The new wink thing was so rare that
okay. You
could almost discount that. But yeah, there was 604-2111. But if you were from a home phone, they did what was called e-digit blocking in a lot of cases.
Right.
So you couldn't do an exchange with the one as a second digit because that was like an area code. And back then they didn't have exchanges like that. But you could blue box it. Then they changed it around so you needed a routing code, like 604, it might have been 059 or something like that to get into the particular.
So at that point you would send KP609, you said it was 05 something start, and then get the connect and then type in your 2111?
No, you do the whole thing. 604-059-2111. With the KP and start at the beginning and all in one swoop, you couldn't dial it from a home. Well, you normally wouldn't want to dial it anyway because it would make a billing ticket. You normally want to blue box it.
Also, that number was dialable if you could somehow find a way to do it?
Yeah. Of course, if you had direct trunks to British Columbia, you could whistle it off, dial something there like directory assistance and whistle it off and just dial KP2111 start. That was another way of doing it.
So if you were in British Columbia and you just dialed 2111 from your phone, it would obviously not go there.
No, because it was in the toll network itself.
Understandable. You have no idea where that came from or what it was or why it was there?
No, there was tons of other numbers, too. There was bunches of conferences up in there. And I don't know why they were there, whose they were or anything. We used them quite a bit, never did find out.
I mean, how do you go about finding something that's not even a valid phone number? I mean, who thinks to call up or to put in an area code plus only four digits?
Well, who thinks of hacking computers to find out what different codings work and find out probably all these programs and things that maybe even the manufacturer doesn't know about? You know, it's that inquisitive mind and, you know, they say a foolproof system cannot be designed because these fools are so darn clever.
I like that. I think I'm going to use that.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's kind of the way it is. You know, us kids, us nerdy, you know, jeans and t-shirt, nerdy kids that, you know, think of all these things, and these engineers think it's just designed so well that, you know, we would never be able to figure it out. But, you know, with time and what they don't see for them, it's just the job. We have this insatiable curiosity that just won't quit. And that is powerful. If they could harness half of that, if they knew how to make a, you know, have a job where you could keep half the creativity you have while you're still a hacker, boy, you know, they'd really be ahead of the game.
Well, what you described is exactly why open source software works the way it does. The people who create because they want to, not because they're just at work.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of companies don't see. Don't mean
I'll have to use that, just at work, JAW, the JAW syndrome, just at work, you know. Or maybe JAJ, just a job.
No matter how good of a programmer you're at, you know, people who want to do it are going to do a job, better job than people who have to. Anyway, that's off subject. We should get back to the telephones and such.
Yeah, well, like, for instance, another one that, you know, somebody found is 914052. That was another legendary conference that maybe the phone company, Long Lines, had put that in there for testing or for some reason.
Right.
But people dialed all the possible O codes in 914. It just spent a while scanning that whole area code because, you know, numbers beginning with 0 or 1 were different kinds of odd things and tests.
Okay, a question about that. Were the test codes always the area code plus 3 digits? Or would there in some cases be a full 7-digit number after the area code for a test circuit?
They could be 6 digits too, like, you know, 052109 or something, if they wanted it to be.
But the most popular ones were just 3 digits.
It could be. But in 052, for instance, we found this conference, so a lot of us were on there. And then there was overseas calls. They couldn't make overseas, but the kids did it anyway. What we did is you dial like 182 or an area code 182, and then it would wink, and you would get a tone and redial. But the conference wouldn't let you redial. But what we'd do, there was a code for hanging up and receiving. So you'd hang up and receive really fast, and it wouldn't release the conference. You'd have that overseas tone. You could dial overseas from there. and the phone company, the long lines, were scratching their heads. They couldn't duplicate it. They were trying to figure out how in the heck are they making these overseas calls in our conference that won't allow them.
Oh, you mean the phone company was actually aware this conference system was being abused and they were watching?
Yeah, they were monitoring the heck out of it. I think it was their own, the 914052. That White Plains, Long Lines or something had it. I don't know exactly who did it or what department of the phone company, what it was for, but...
Oh, speaking of White Plains, I think that's a city... I remember, I've obviously been doing a lot of reading on this, that there was one city where you would just pick up your phone at your regular residence and hit the flash of girl card and you were introduced to a trunk line. Have you ever heard of that happening before?
In California, you could dial a 1, I think, and maybe one other digit or something. It was down-upping, as it was affectionately called. And you didn't need a blue box in that case. You were on a trunk and you could dial calls out on it, I think.
So were you going to type it like 1-9 or something that would give you a chirp?
It wouldn't even be a chirp, you'd be, or maybe it did need a blue box. But yeah, it wouldn't even give you a chirp. You'd get your local, like a wink, you know, a DC wink in the local system. And so there was no 2600 or anything, and there was a guy that did that for years, and he died after a while, and he was never even visited by security.
Well, I think security visited people who made extraordinarily long calls to directory assistance and toll-free numbers.
Yeah, and he never did directory assistance, of course.
If that method, you're not making any calls at all. Your phone
yeah.
was not even in use.
Yeah, he would only dial 1-9, and that's all he ever dialed. And whatever it was, maybe it was just a 1, but I think it was like 1 digit afterwards. So maybe
I highly doubt that just a 1 would do it, or a lot more people would have discovered that.
Yeah, and it was a down-up of a certain length, and it might have even been 2 digits. I don't know, 1 and another 2 digits.
He used to do a lot of hand scanning that time.
What?
Did he used to scan a lot of numbers?
Yeah. And this was FAMA, it was called. The system was STEP. Automatic message accounting, so it was only steps, only in Southern California, where this thing, down-upping, worked.
Wow.
That's pretty cool. Now, have you any idea how that it is working? Now, first of all, the name, down-upping, where's that derived from, do you know?
Hanging up the hook momentarily and then picking it back up again to get your trunk.
But you weren't doing that in case you were just simply dialing a number.
No, you dial like a 1 or 2 digit number after the 1, and then you'd hang up momentarily and pick it up, just what you were talking about.
Oh, see, I didn't know, but the way you were explaining it sounded like you simply dial the number and get a trunk. Oh.
No, you had to do the down-up.
I understand.
You know, flashing the hook, and then you'd get the trunk. Now, there was another thing in Fort Myers, Florida in 1970 when I went up there. You would dial a number, and if you downed up, you would... It was an NX1 type of exchange made by North Electric for the independent telephone company. And certain numbers, like directory assistance, you could down up or, you know, hang up momentarily and pick up. And you'd be out on a trunk. And if it was dial pulse, you could dial on your rotary dial. And that would be converted along the way to 2600. You'd be dialing like right through to Cincinnati or something. And you could on your rotary dial dial like 513-121 and stop. And it would give you inward.
So you're telling me that with that system configured the way it was, you could essentially go to like a payphone, call 411. What did you say that the trick was to get to the?
I don't know about a payphone, but directory assistance from a regular phone, like from the hotel I was staying at, the Holiday Inn in Fort Myers, you could dial out to directory assistance 555-1212, and then down up. I was whistling off, and then I realized, oh, you don't even have to whistle off because the reversal in the DC connection comes right back to your exchange and right back to your phone.
So you simply hit the hook switch, and you can actually just rotary dial your number. So you could essentially call anywhere without even having to possess a blue box in that certain area.
That's right. Now, most trunks did need a blue box, but you'd find the group that didn't and just use that exclusively. For instance, Cincinnati was one that... happened to dial pulse. I think they didn't have enough MF trunks or enough MF receivers for that read or something. Enough relays to make it go to an MF receiver or something. So that was dial pulse. So as long as you did everything through Cincinnati, you would down up and then, rotary dial the area code. Let's say you were calling Boston. You do the 617-121 or 617 in your whole number, you know, or whatever. And yeah, like you said, you just didn't need a blue box.
Well, that's pretty neat. That's
what you in effect had was because you were doing inwards and stuff, but, you know, the toll test board on 101, and you could just get any of that stuff, you know, partial numbers. You'd pause, it would pause like a second or so, and know that you had finished dialing, and then it would cut you through like the,
The machine will automatically send the start, and when you dial it, will convert it to MF, and then at the end, it'll send send the start at the end, send the keep off at the beginning.
Yeah.
That's weird. That's so cool.
And it was all rotary dial.
Oh, man.
So like you said, you didn't even need a blue box, but in effect, it was, you know, like you could, call, New York 212-121. Some people were afraid to dial whole numbers in case it was ticketing, so they would generally go through inwards, 212-121.
Right.
How many people were involved in this here? Was the scene really big back then?
I don't know. There was a lot in California and Seattle and New York. They tended to be the hotbeds. But there was a guy in Montana, for instance, that was kind of big into it, Great Falls. And there was Ray in Oklahoma that wrote an article in Ramparts magazine about the black box.
So when did phone phreaking in general become noticed by Bell Systems?
Probably in the late 60s, and by the early 70s, they've done a number of arrests. They were starting to crack down, I guess, but it was for 5 years, maybe.
That long, huh?
It was the heyday.
What were the legal repercussions like back in the early days for phone phreaking?
Well, it was like possession and use of devices, schemes, methods, devices for depriving the telephone company of their lawful revenue.
Well, schemes can mean just written instructions, can it?
Yeah.
So theoretically, the famous 1970s Esquire article about blue boxing, would be illegal to have a copy of that magazine?
I don't know if that would be detailed enough.
It describes exactly how it's done, minus the key ingredients like the frequencies involved.
Yeah, I never had the article read to me, so I, that would be up to a court to decide, I guess, whether that was really giving enough information, or I think, you could tell somebody how to rob a bank, but is that really illegal, if they're not intending to go out and do it?
I've actually read. Go ahead.
Did the laws put a stop to your freaking at all?
Well, when I got arrested, that just scared me, and I kind of was pretty much over it after that. Yeah, I guess I only got like a suspended, like a city charge, so it was kind of a local misdemeanor. I was very lucky, and I don't know. By then, too, the phone company got more friendly with me, and I was, I could learn without all that. I was more interested in learning, so I never really did much after 1971.
Well, that's what this is all about, learning, and people fail to see that. And of course, the bookies are in just for the money, but that's the exception to the rule.
Yeah, people were buying blue boxes for $2,000 and stuff like that,
Were the parts required to make a blue box really that hard to come by? Were charging $2,000 for an assembled one was realistic?
Pretty close to $2,000. It would probably be about $20 if you bought really good parts, like a twin T good stable oscillator, better than a lot of the people use. You could get, little toroid coils and stuff, and so maybe $30. I don't know. It wouldn't probably be in that kind of range, with the coils and everything. If you made it really nice, with maybe a good pad.
So.
Basically, transistors, resistors, capacitors, and coils.
So basically, selling blue boxes is more profitable than selling drugs back in this time. Because you can buy the parts for under $50 and turn around and sell the machine for $2,000.
Yeah, so these underworld or bookie figures. Because my father, when he worked on the docks, the guy there told him he wasn't so much interested in making the free calls, but the idea of being able to conceal the origin and destination of calls.
Right.
So, we could whistle off Chicago, and he'd get billed for Chicago, but the call would actually be to Hawaii.
Right.
And of course, it would be hard to get caught that way because when they're looking for people hacking the system, they don't check for calls that are actually being billed, right?
Although they did add to the law concealing the origin and or destination of a phone call is one of the things that were illegal to just address that very thing.
Is that illegal under today's laws? Because I wonder if any felon potentially would be illegal.
That I don't know.
Because if that's the case, I need to modify a computer program I got learned in the other room.
Yeah, I don't know what the laws are so much more broad and strict, you know, with terrorism and all that. I don't really know. I haven't even kept up with.
How did call tracing work back then?
Like in a step exchange, they would read, they would find one switch. Like, let's say if they knew the phone number that you had called, they'd go to that connector switch, and there'd be a tag on it showing what switch trunked back to that, the next selector back. And they'd go to that one, find the label, and go, and they'd have to run maybe up three floors. And, the switches might be on a whole different floor as they were running through and tracing. And then they'd get to a trunk, and they'd call the other office to have them start at that incoming trunk and do the same thing again.
So at any given time, if someone disconnected, all these arms and levers would reset, and they'd be screwed?
Yeah. In Crossbar, it was they would have to look at verticals and horizontals that operated on the switches. Although they could set up a thing where it would actually print out a trouble card if you called a certain number, if they had the number
like
ready, if they knew ahead of time.
If they would like to
ever, go
ahead.
Was there some thing that ever the telco was able to lock onto your line and not let you hang up?
Instead, they could put a diode on your connector switch, so once the step, reversed, the diode would conduct and it would hold up the line as long as the called party left the phone off the hook, and they use that a lot for crank callers and stuff in steps.
So you would make a harassing or illegal phone call, and before they even started tracing the call, they put a diode at the end receiver switch, and then everything would stay open, so they'd actually take their time tracing back the call. That's accurate.
Usually these were put on when they knew that the person was getting harassed. They wouldn't usually do it while a call was in progress, because that one, once they knew of a call in progress, they could just put a butt in across the line and keep it off hook or something, or hold it up.
So if someone, for example, was making threats to somebody, and they called progress, they would be able to keep this line open and then take their time tracing the call back and not have to worry about the person hanging up. Is that how I'm understanding this?
Yeah, that's right. If they actually shorted the line or got to it, but the diodes, they would put them on every connector in that last digits of the line, the hundreds group, ahead of time, if they already knew, who was getting the calls. And anybody in that 100 group was involved, even if they were innocent. So if, like, an old lady got a call and she kind of dropped the phone or forgot to hang it up, you'd end up holding that person up.
Was there any way to defeat the locking line?
That's a good question.
Yeah. I didn't actually do this, but I know it would work. You would send, like, 70 volts or enough to buck the 48 volts battery and ground on the connector, maybe 90 volts the other direction, and if you were in the same central office, it would definitely work, and in some cases, to nearby central offices on the step, if you actually were fed their battery. If it went through, like, pulse repeaters and stuff, it wouldn't, but especially within the central office, you could send the voltage the opposite way than the voltage you were receiving, and then the switch wouldn't hold up anymore. So yeah, that could be done.
Oh, that's neat. The file I read actually, which I know was bogus, said that you had to use a lot of voltage on your line, but I'm thinking that would just keep the line open even longer. But I do see how sending voltage on would force a disconnect, and that's a
you'd
doing it.
Yeah, you'd buck the 48 volts battery, it'd be enough so that the switch would see the line the other way. It would look like it was in the normal condition instead of the off-hook condition, and then the diodes wouldn't be conducting anymore, and it would drop you.
And I bet you the phone company technicians were scratching their heads trying to figure out how you got around their little walk-in.
Yeah, because it, I know somebody did actually try it, and it worked. Well, Test Board used to use that method for releasing lines that were held up for one reason or another, you know, like to get the person's line released. I forget what they called it, but basically that's what the Test Board did, because Test Board, you can get up on the line, and you could actually send your own battery and ground from Test Board, and they would, you know, send enough to, you know, disconnect, a CPH release, so you could call call party hold.
That's also very interesting. Seems like we're getting low on topics here. Anybody else, any questions? Anyone?
I don't think so. Anybody else have any more questions?
I know I'm going to think of some more as soon as, the show's over.
Yeah, I'll probably think of some answers I should have given, too. But, you know, I'm looking for a 16-button, like a regular 2500 phone, nice standard phone with a 16-button. So I've got a little pad that, it's interesting that in the IC chip on all touch-tone phones, they have those 16-button tones right in there.
Well, that actually, you sort of just popped another topic all by itself. What were those extra ABCD tones used for back in the day?
A lot of things, really. They were used in Audubon, the military communications, to do priority calling, to override. They were used in subsurface observing circuits. They were used in call diverters. The factory could reset your call diverter, the security code, I think, or something, by using one of those, or just tons of, like, little miscellaneous sort of things.
Well, I remember about 4 years ago, I was taking a tour of my local 911 emergency center, and I noticed all the phones there had the extra ABCD tones on them, but the person giving the tour said she didn't even know what they were for. They were just sort of there, so who knows, right?
Yeah, since they're available, and they probably, like directory assistance, that was another thing. If you call directory assistance and while the phone was still ringing, you held down the D tone to the right of the pound. When the ring stopped, you'd get an interrupted dial tone, and you could, instead of directory assistance, and you could dial these one-digit test codes. Like, one would answer at the test board for that automatic call distributor, two was 1,000 cycle, and there was even a loop around on there. I think it was like 8, 9, or 7, and 8 for the two ports.
And I think that those last a little longer than everything else. Were those test codes still lingering around when everything else was getting shut down?
Yeah, there was one or two of those ACDs left. But directory assistance, when they connected you with something, too, like if they had to connect you with other directory assistances, they might be told to do, you know, the start or whatever it was to get the console out and do like A9 or A20 or B28 or something. They'd do one of these 16 buttons.
Now, could a phone number, an actual phone number, ever contain the ABCD tones? Such as, like, you know, 412ABC or 412-12A or something like that?
It could be programmed that way, but they aren't. They usually, like, would drop out or send you to the,
Well, actually, I do suppose that is a stupid question, so I'm just now remembering that the bull box tones didn't even have ABC and D.
Right.
So now, there's a total of 16 on the touch tone. It's 15 is the whole blue box complement. In other words, if
right,
you use...
I'm starting to wonder now if numbers would be able to exist to contain A, B, C, and D because the switches wouldn't be able to dial to one another.
I had a phone one time that had special buttons on it, like a regular... it was actually a touch-tone phone, but it still had, like, KP and different start and stuff on it.
Really?
On the actual phone.
You sure they're willing to switch over to MF?
No. I don't even think you could switch it over to be a pulse. You couldn't even switch it over to pulse. It was just DTMF.
What does the extra KPSTMF buttons do?
I don't know.
You don't remember?
It just had extra buttons on it.
The touch tone and MF are completely different arrangements of tones, too, so they don't even correspond. You know, like in the touch tone, 1, 2, and 3 have a common tone, whereas they wouldn't in the blue boxing, let's say, but
after listening to Joy Bubbles, I started wondering if, like, you know, if you were to combine the tones, you know, like, let's say, you know, like, one, like, let's say KP, and then, like, maybe 03 and then start, you know, if that would create a tone or something. You know.
It's all very interesting.
I don't know
not
if it was
really. And the 16 button, if it was the MF to a central office, it would actually not be sending the tones. It would be sending something already in MF anyway. So it would something that it wouldn't be valid anyway, so they're not really valid if you use it. But some voicemails, for instance, use those, you know, like you could get it to tell you what generic it's on by sending one of those tones and the Octel type voicemail. You could do an A, I don't know if it's A, B, C, or D, and maybe another digit or something. People have played with that. So there's tons of little miscellaneous uses that they're put to.
Right.
Well, yeah, it'd be great to backdoor a system because, you know, hardly anybody's going to be able to even think to send one of those tones along.
Yeah.
I had read somewhere, and I think this is total bull, but it is possible, that under the systems of the 90s, not quite the heyday of the blue boxing, but still at the same time, not where everything's electronic, where you would be able to, with regular DTMF on a regular home phone, push A, an area code, pound, and get like a Navy base, and like A412 pound would get you a naval base in Pittsburgh, or B412 would get you an Army base, or
no, I think that was completely bogus, because they weren't even, the local central offices weren't even allowed for those tones, and even on military lines, you had to be on the right one that was would even allow those priorities to work. Like it said, this priority you're trying to use on this Audubon line is not acceptable, or please check, you know, your system administrator or whatever. I don't remember.
Well, the way it was explained to me that it was some kind of bridge between the public network and the military network, where, you know, A, B, C, and D would correspond to the four branches of the military, whereas Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force.
That's completely bogus. They never had those in the local central offices to even work on standard lines.
Right.
But they did have 710. Now, the area code 710, now it's like an emergency thing. It's a little more unclassified. But back in the 80s and early 90s, they had this sort of system that was made up from kind of on the fly. And you could get all these converted numbers, and it was different military bases, and they had like only two central offices in each town were picked as the hubs for 710, and it was kind of secret.
Go ahead.
I'm going to be standing that one out.
Well, actually, 710 was explained to me by our friend Decoder that it was there was only two numbers that exist in that entire area code. And later on in the same call, a few hours later, we were talking about the AT&T's 959 test exchange, where any area code plus 959 plus a number only works if you're calling from AT&T or through AT&T's PIC code 1010280.
So I need 8,
actually. Well, 0 is for the operator. You're right, 1010280. That's my mistake. I'm just used to down with 0 after it.
Yeah, it would be 288 and 0. But before, see, the 710 was an entirely different system that doesn't exist. Or at least you can't get it anymore if it does. They had thousands and thousands of numbers on 710.
And these were
back.
These were free to call from anywhere. You would go up to a payphone, dial it, and get connected.
I don't know if it would how it would work from a payphone, but from the two exchanges in the town, you could dial it, and they converted. There was all these exchanges, and they converted to other numbers and different. Some of the thousands groups went to like Audubon and government agencies. There was, I think, agriculture and forest service, and all kinds of Air Force bases that. You'd go in on numbers that weren't direct dialable except off of a PBX or something, and it was just, I didn't really spend too much time with it, but I found lots of exchanges that converted. As a matter of fact, one was 959. It wasn't really a test exchange, but it converted to some exchange in Rochester, New York.
Well, actually, I was about to bring that up because I was dialing random numbers. I was going 1010280. I'm sorry, 1010281, 710959, and just trying to do, you know, easily guessable numbers. And one of the first ones I hit was 2000, and much to my surprise, someone answered the phone. And she answered the phone, "Macy's, may I help you?" And I'm like, I just hung up, because I kind of panicked, didn't know what this was.
At first I thought it was probably just the Rochester Exchange, or maybe it was still Rochester.
It wasn't Rochester. I eventually called back, gave her some bogus story, and it was a pizza shop in, I don't remember where, but I think it was Idaho, some not very popular state.
Yeah, I was on the line when you made that call.
Yeah. Where was it at? Yeah. Do you remember?
I'm not sure. I got it through. I got to go.
Okay.
But see, 710 was completely different, and they had all these mysterious conversions that they... Actually, there was a time, sometimes they would be dialable, and sometimes they wouldn't.
And that's exactly what I'm thinking. I think they still use it, but I think they only use it for short periods of time, because whenever I had discovered, now 959-2000 on 710, it would actually convert to some other area code and prefix 2000. It wasn't even 959. It was something, something, 2000.
Oh, it was just because they didn't pay their bills, so they ripped it out.
Is it possible that we could agree with it after all?
Now, that number stopped working about 3 days after I told people about it, and that's what I was about to get to. And that leads me to believe that, for example, let's say the president is in town, he needs to have a 710 forwarder. They probably just forward the entire exchange. So 710-959 plus anything goes to 710, whatever the president's current prefix is, his, and then if you dial the right number, you get in. So,
well, there was tons of other exchanges anyway that all did stuff.
Now, were only military numbers, you know, converted, or was there really conversions to see it? There was a pizza shop.
There was both. There was like the pizza shop type thing, and there was military numbers too, different exchanges.
So they just converted the whole damn area and didn't care. You know, if, let's say this area has a 500, you know, 5,000 block of military numbers.
Well, it was really like one exchange. They would convert to one area code and pick your other unrelated exchange. Like 710-959 at that time, I think the whole thing converted to Rochester. So it probably changes periodically. You never know, you know, but basically there's just like one number officially there.
Yeah, 710-CS gets, but that's a whole other story. I think there would be a great project of a group of people to obtain the current directory for 710. Challenging, yet rewarding.
Nice.
Yeah. It won't be me.
Yeah, well, it's probably going to be me, but I didn't say that, so.
Actually, there was a thing I did on 710. It wasn't in exchanges around here, like even big government exchanges, when they needed it to be, once they did the gets, they needed to be all over the country. And they had it left out, and they didn't want to listen to me and repair, so I called a CEO, and the next morning it was fixed in my exchange. And then within a few weeks, it was, without me even reporting the other ones, they got it in the exchanges it was left out in.
Nice.
And so, because, you know, like, some of the exchange I reported was one where they had the FBI numbers and government center numbers, and, you know, it needed to be there, you know, because you don't plan for an emergency, and it's better to have it in ready for the emergency than then try to find it's not in and get it put in hurriedly and all that, you know.
So would it be possible to kind of, I'm not sure about nowadays, but then that system to, let's say, have, you know, 710-584 forward to, like, 412-584, and then that way you can call yourself for free using that 710 from a payphone?
Yeah, I don't know how that would be done or who even has control of that stuff or anything. I kind of kept away from it because...
I would, too. It's obviously a hot topic as far as troublemaking.
Yeah, so I've always stayed mostly with the civilian stuff, but especially the last several years. But there was back in the day, several area codes had this 840 exchange, and it was vacant except for like 123X, like 1234. They all, the last digit was irrelevant, and it would answer 840 operator.
Interesting. Wasn't that called an intercept operator, where they just answer the phone out of nothingness?
No, it wasn't intercept. I asked, where are you? I can't tell you that. Are
Wait. That was you?
Yeah.
Ah, so
And I said, well, where are you? You know, I can't tell you. Are you military or civilian? I can't tell you that. I worked for the phone company at the time in Denver, so I said, well, call me back. I was just testing this line. So somebody called me back, and it was 2600, you know, and they said, no, we can't tell you anything about this, and you're not to dial it again. I said, oh, I thought it was regular, maybe a phone company or, you know, a business number or something, but, if, you know, then I won't call it anymore. That's very good, he said. I said, okay, you know, and I did, but, you know, later on, supposedly it was this Greenbrier where they had the retreat for the president. They said they had numbers in there and a reporter kind of exposed it or something. And allegedly, the 840 was for that.
It was 840-480-1234.
No, 840 was the number, so it was like in several area codes, like 304-840-1234 or 704-840-1234
or 804-840. Yeah, 804-840-1234. I read an article. This is actually widely distributed in a document called the Aaron Archer's Cookbook called Bad as Shit. And it explains exactly what you're explaining to me. But the person in the story actually was able to identify that the number was the president's bomb shelter, but not where it was.
And there's also an article in 2600 called The Scariest Number of the World. I think it's about the same thing.
Interesting. Very
yeah, and I had discovered it one night, actually, at home when I lived in Denver. And so after the guy called me, I said, yeah, this is the thing I should fool with. And I just laid off of it. But it was interesting. You would whistle off, and it was a direct ring down trunk. So you'd whistle, and the ring would just stop. And when you'd let your whistle up, it would re-seize the trunk immediately, just the ring would just start right away again.
Oh, so that's how you knew it was something special.
Yeah, and the echo suppressors, I would dial like 704-840, and we didn't have echo suppressors there, but this thing did, so it was a long circuit, you know, out of state from Charlotte. It wasn't in North Carolina, but yet you dialed this Charlotte number.
Now, would it have been possible, had you known what it was, to pull a verification on it?
No, it was a separate, it wasn't a phone number, it was a special trunk, so no, it would be a verification trunk on there.
Very, very interesting.
Because it didn't convert to a phone number, you know, like the 800 for that White House signal or whatever allegedly he did, which I can, you know, I can definitely say it was possible, but that at least, those 800s had to have a telephone number, so if you knew the conversion, I'm not sure how you'd find it, but... You know, since it's there, I'm sure it's findable, or was.
Well, the way it was explained in the file I read was that each prefix after 800, like 800-200 would be this certain city, and 800-201 would be this certain city.
Yeah, 800-424 was Washington, but the next three digits after the 424 determined what prefix was, so if you knew the conversion for any one in that tenth block, you'd know the conversion for the rest of them.
Well, that's probably how they did it. They saw this number was, you know, 800-200-1234, and they're like, well, that has to be somewhere in the vicinity of Monroeville, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and it was 800-424 was Washington, by the way.
There you go.
And then the next three digits after that determined what central office it converted to. So if it was 800-424-9827, all the 982s after the 424 had to go to the same CO. So if you knew where 9821 was, then you'd know where 9827 went.
That's pretty neat. Pretty neat stuff.
And so it had to be, well, it was 368 for like Arlington, Virginia, I think around there that later was in, but most of them were 424 at that time. And there's still some Washington numbers left on 424 from the old days.
Huh.
There still are?
Yeah, I don't know if they're, although now they could, you know, you can have 424s in California or New York or anything, they don't, but I mean, just people that kept their numbers, they don't make you change your number, so if I would have had a Washington, D.C. number, you know, in 1970 and still had it, it would be a 424.
That's pretty neat. Another thing I read about was back in the day, I believe certain areas you could dial inwards directly. Like, for example, you just, from a regular phone, you dial 1, and an area code, then 121 pound, and in some areas, I think New York City was one of them, it would actually connect you all the way through and not, you know, restrict you from dialing an inward number. Is there any truth behind that? Have you ever experienced that?
Yeah, there was several ways. If you did, you'd always have to do 10 digits from a regular phone, but there was D-digit unblocking. They were supposed to have 1 and 0 after an area code blocked, a D-digit. And, like, particularly at number 5 crossbars, they quite often forgot to either do digit 0 or D-digit 1 or both, or sometimes in only one marker. A marker was a big control wired logic thing that controls the number 5 crossbar, and you had to block it in each marker. So if you forgot in one or another one, you could either all the time or sometimes dial an area code plus 0 or an area code plus 1 or both.
And so you type in like 1-412-121-0000 and you get an indoor operator at 412?
Yeah.
And the last 4 just completely didn't matter. You can dial whatever you wanted to, but they were basically ignored.
Well, in the late 60s, even later than that, they put in digit counters that made you not be able to do that anymore because of too many digits. But at least in the early 60s and on up, in the 60s, you could do like the 0000, yeah, like you said, get Pittsburgh inward. And I was on an exchange, it was a new crossbar in 1961, and I could do it. For instance, I could do, and you could even stack 2 area codes because they didn't have area code exchanges. So let's say I wanted, Miami or, Orlando inward, which is 305 at that time. I could do it through Pittsburgh if I wanted 1-412-305-1211. Because I was already at 305 and it wouldn't let me dial 305, so I would dial Miami or Orlando inward through Pittsburgh.
Right.
Yeah. Besides the 121 for inward, what other operator codes existed that were pretty commonplace?
The most common ones were 131 for directory assistance, 141 for route and rate, 181 for toll station, these small, very small towns that were like a ring down, the operator would ring.
Mm-hmm.
And then the test codes, these are called the 100 codes. These were the 100 was a balance, like a silent termination. And 101 was the test board itself, they would answer. 102 was 1,000 cycle. 103 was a supervision test. You'd get it to flash off of an onhook and stuff.
Right.
104 was like a two-way transmission measuring test. There was a few they added later, but those were the most common.
Right.
That's pretty neat.
Those are all still pretty much the same, too.
I don't really... do you know anything about the current system at all, the current telephone network?
No, I can't dial, at least not with respect to the ones and zeros. Even if my exchange let them through, they block them from equal access type trunks.
Right.
So if I unblocked it, my exchange, I would still fail.
Well, I know the second I pick up my phone, dial one area code and a one. As soon as I let off the one key, I'm getting a recording. Same with zero.
Yeah, now ours, it lets you dial 3 digits or 4 digits, depending on whether it's an older area code or new. But so, like, if I dial 1-617-121, it would wait till I dial the 121 and then give me the recording.
Oh.
But they can... put it in here so it would stop right after the first 1 or 0.
So that's a local switch setting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but at any rate, they don't let them through. But if they did let them through, it would fail.
Interesting.
Because we have equal access type trunks, and they have it in the 4Es, AT&T knows to block them from equal access trunks.
I've noticed that in some cases numbers get intercepted when you call them. And the big one is directory assistance. For example, if I were to dial, 555-1212, I'd always get Verizon directory assistance, no matter if I was calling, 1-310-44 or 551212, which would be Los Angeles. I would get Verizon nationwide. They intercept all 555-1212. And I know from having access to a VoIP phone that actually, connects you to any number you dial, that if I were to dial 310-555-1212 on a VoIP phone that does not intercept that number, I will get the bona fide Los Angeles directory assistance. And,
AT&T, all of them go to the subcontractor for AT&T. So the area code is 555-1212, depending on what carrier you use, actually can go different places.
Well, I remember with playing with a VoIP system that allowed us to call a number over and over again to harass people. We typed in 310-555-1212, and it would automatically keep calling back. And we were getting some of the same operators over and over and over again. So one of the guys got the bright idea to act like they were a technician and then troubleshoot the problem and asked the lady, okay, what company is this? And they're like, well, we work for, the phone company. And it turns out that it wasn't any type of contractor at all, but it was people that were answering numbers that came in to the actual phone number, 555-1212. And she explained to us that a lot of people who dial 551212 don't get them. They get intercepted and put to a third-party company. So I'm wondering if that is that office just there to catch the, any calls that don't automatically get intercepted like they're supposed to, actually get
sent through? Different carriers use different directory assistant subcontractors, too, so there's going to be different ways of handling 555-1212. Some carriers are going to send to your local company directory assistants, like you said, in California.
So what happens if, by one means or another, you manage to get your call for 551212 to travel all the way to the switch that actually handles that number? Will it then just be whisked away to whatever party handles that phone carrier? Basically, is it possible to actually dial 551212 and have it go somewhere?
That isn't a real telephone number. That's a trunk connection.
Okay.
Different carriers are going to send it to different places. They can elect where they want to.
Well, basically, trying to find out if numbers that you're not supposed to be able to dial directly, if you actually somehow push that number to the switch that handles it, if it'll ignore it at the last minute. Let's say I want to call an inward operator in Los Angeles. I'm in Pittsburgh. I dial 310-121. My switch isn't going to allow that. It's going to give me a recording the second I dial 1. But let's say some way, somehow, I manage to push the call all the way down to the switch that's actually in Los Angeles. It doesn't handle the 312 area code.
No, if you could get out of your switch, it would fail because you're an equal access type trunk.
So, in the modern system, how is it possible to get an inward number? Do you have to have the operator do it for you?
Yeah, the operator would have to do it because, or if you could get your OSPS, they, you know, dialing it like through the credit card, various system, the calling card thing where it goes bonk.
Right.
If that thing was ever to let you dial out with ones and zeros, it might let you through on some of them.
Some of them, but not all of them?
Yeah, if they had like an O code and then a 4-digit operator type number.
So if I wanted to push through to 310-121-1234, that may have a chance of actually succeeding?
No, but 024-1150 might get you there. That's like operator 50. I don't know if they still use those, but it would be...
What's
the O code for? I just made that up, just a sample O code.
Oh. So 121 wouldn't work, it has to be an O code?
Yeah. Because you'd need a total of 10 digits on the, you know, the calling card system. So probably the best way of doing it, about the only way of doing it, would be for the operator to do it somehow.
That's definitely worth exploring. Speaking of which, are you familiar with how DAT2s work? It's more of a modern thing.
No, what's it called?
DAT2, Direct Access Test Unit. It's a number you can dial up and perform various tests to a subscriber line. But one thing very notable about it is after you connect to it and log in via a password, it asks you what number you want to connect to. And once you type in that number with DTMF, very faintly in the background, you hear it redialing that number in MF, complete with the KP 7-digit number start. And I'm wondering why it's using a signaling system that I was under the impression was is completely obsoleted and not being used anymore.
They use it for like intercept now, like the AIS generally uses OSPS, the operator system uses MF to call in. Like if you dial 0 and a number on AT&T or like 00, it's actually using MF to get to that AT&T system.
And that would be dialing an inward operator or an inward number?
No, your local operator, your local long-distance operator, like AT&T, OSPS, where it says dial the number you want to call and all that. That's actually MFing a number, you know, like zero, or like start, or KP start, and then your telephone number with a couple information digits before it.
Well, we'll use an RCAT or just record an announcement for error debugging or something.
What did you say?
He said it was used by the RCAT in some cases for error debugging, and I think he explained this to me already. What was working is if you call a number that doesn't exist, you hear it keying that number into a recorder, into a system that's possibly dropping a trouble ticket on it for reference. Is that about right?
Probably not, but intercept uses MF, like these automatic intercept systems and maybe whatever circuit the test board, the DAT2 connects to, you know, has always used EMF, but they just, like 950, that old long distance number is the EMF, so that's, my exchange has plenty, you know, it can send out EMF.
So where are the MF2? What kind of machine is still listening to this?
For instance, the AIS, the automatic intercept system that tells you your number has been changed or disconnected. That listens for MF. Our local zero and the number for the local telephone company operator, that's hearing MF.
Again, and again, whenever you, let's say I pick up my phone, I dial 0412 12 whatever, or 0124 and a real number. Where is it MFing that to? It's picking up some kind of trunk system and MFing it somewhere?
Yeah, your exchange on a 0412, let's say you used AT&T. So some of the carriers don't use MF, but we're going to, let's say AT&T 0412, let's say,
with 3-5-1-8-2-5, something like that. Any normal real phone number?
Yeah, normal real phone number with MF to AT&T's OSPS, the Operator Services Position System.
And at what point they would pick up and say, how do you want to build this call?
Yeah.
So even if you want
to... automated now, yes, the automated system that would be saying that. But that's, to get there, you've actually EMF'd.
Right.
The like KP and the call number at start, and then it waits for the off. It waits for the off hook, or well, depends on the system. But then you do KP and some information digits and the number you're calling from.
So even if you were to somehow jack that system, it really wouldn't get you anywhere because that machine is for billing purposes, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think of a way to hop around the phone network, today's modern network, using any method. And if I'm very close to my central office, getting inside is not a problem. They leave one of the windows open every night. And I wouldn't mind going in there and then, you know, having some fun. But I'm crazy, I know. What else you said?
Well, talk about crazy. There was a guy that went into the central office every day for about 4 or 6 months or something. And he would hang around there, like, to copy documents and stuff. And he kind of, like, the regular guys thought he was Western because they were installing stuff, and he'd kind of go into the break room and sit there and drink coffee for a while and stuff, and, you know, he would, you know, like, analyze, spread out these big, you know, CDs and SDs of circuit description and schematic diagram and sort of peer at him, but, you know, it looked like he was sort of half working and yawn a little. He said he kind of put on, like, a bored look off and on because he really took it, but he'd take stuff home every night. He got tons of stuff, and then he was finally just afraid he was doing it too long, because, you know, but everybody kind of thought he was Western. The Western guys thought he was Pacific Telephone.
And he never got busted for it?
No, he left before. He kind of started getting afraid that he might or something, and he left. He's been there several months, so.
That was right around towards the end?
Huh?
That was right around towards the end for him? He just decided to quit.
Yeah, he just left there, and nobody knew. They probably thought he went back to Western, you know, because Western Electric, he'd be there for a while anyway, and he just, you know, kind of said, yeah, I'm going to go back somewhere, you know, go, they think I'm gonna, they're going to transfer me out of here, I'll know tomorrow or something, and he was just gone.
Wow.
Yeah, perfect crime. Probably never got, no one ever noticed that, you know?
No, and they just figured he looked like he was working. He wasn't really, you know, doing anything suspicious. He was just busy working and looking at these SDs and copying them and stuff and peering at these BSPs, and sometimes he would go over and, like, look at cross connects and stand there at the frame counting terminals or something and looking bored, and then sit in the break room for a while, but nobody fussed at him for taking too long of a break, you know. That made him kind of look like one of the guys, and he stuck some beer in there one time.
Oh, good God. So he was one of everyone's best friends.
Yeah.
No one there to ask him for ID if he was bringing beer for him, you know?
Yeah, and he had some sort of ID, but, you know, he just sort of flashed it. They saw this thing, and, you know, you don't really look too good, especially if you had an ID. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he pulls it out, you know, real confidently. And besides, if they looked at it, it sets in, you know, bell system or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Class 3 or admittance or something. Yeah, and they would think, oh, that's maybe it's some kind of Western ID or something, Western Electric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the local one here uses HID cards that open the door, so it's kind of high tech, but they leave one of the windows open all day, every day.
Wow. Yeah, back in the 70s, you know, he didn't, I don't think his card even opened the door. He would just, you know, walk in and sit down at a table there and spread stuff. And mainly he was there to get stuff. He wanted to stuff, you know.
Yeah, but you can't just walk in, grab some shit and leave. That looks way too suspicious. You gotta spend some time there.
Yeah, and he would come every day and spend the whole 8 hours, which is quite a thing.
Something like I would do, honestly.
Yeah, it's quite a lot to go through just to get, you know, 1,000 documents or something. But he got a whole big, over months, you know, a whole big series of BSPs. He didn't want to bring too many home at a time, but I think he said he had like 300 or 400 of them.
Wow.
Yeah, very good. Very, very good.
Big binders of stuff, because he would bring an empty binder once. I think, take this whole binder here. Yeah, there's nothing in it. Yeah. Then he would bind all his stuff that he'd already brought home other days, you know.
Right.
Because he wanted an official Bell System binder.
Oh, wow. Hardcore.
Yeah, that way he wouldn't have to carry the binder out full of stuff. He'd take home an old empty binder that nobody didn't look too bad. Then he would take home, like, you know, 3 or 4 BSPs, but just keep doing that day after day.
Yeah, as long as you don't get greedy, you just have to take the whole library home with you, no one's going to even blink an eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he looked properly bored. You know, he tried not to be too happy about anything, you know.
Well, back to the subject of inward numbers. Would it be possible, I'm not sure if you know this, under the modern system, to provision your line for the ability to dial inward numbers directly?
Well, the problem is you would have to not send equal access. You know, any line in the office, if it would let you dial the one, you know, uses equal access signaling. So you'd have to set up a root index and build a special class of service to just send, like, the KP and the number on a feature group C trunk to AT&T. If you went on feature group C, I think it might let inward go through on those. Those act differently, and it wouldn't be equal access, but they might have even started blocking those from COs. But that may probably be your only chance to be able to get inward would be to put it up on a feature group C trunk.
Well, is there any way to, if you had switch access or social engineering by any means possible, to orchestrate it in such a way where you can directly dial into a system that's capable of receiving a MF command and then processing a call? Similar to the way the blue boxing worked in the past, but with modern equipment.
Yeah, that's what you could probably do on a feature group C.
So I would have to learn how to program a DMS, you know, 100 or whatnot.
Quite sophisticated to be able to do, because you'd have to develop a whole class of service with a different, totally different routing than any other. It wouldn't be just unblocking something.
Yeah.
You know, it would be building a lot of programming stuff.
Ideal situation would be to create the commands necessary, make it all perfect, and then just walk in there like you own the place, walk up to the terminal, and just start keying the information in. I basically want a number where I can dial some kind of special code, maybe a 3-digit code or something that would go unnoticed for a while, or maybe just a regular 7-digit phone number and a non-existent prefix.
You can have a non-existent prefix to go up to a link type trunk and MF in there, let's say.
Yeah, so basically from my own phone or from a pay phone or from anywhere that the switch is hooked to, and let's say, because my local area code is 724, and I know there's nothing on like 959, or that's already reserved for testing, but just find some prefix that's totally bogus, and then put its number in there, and you call it, and it'll just wink at you. And then you type in your KP phone number start, and it would actually process the call. Any way possible that's possible.
Yeah, you'd have to know how to build it. You know, there'd be a lot of programming involved.
But basically, I guess the root question is, MF is still used for signaling.
Yeah. In isolated cases, you'd have to find the parameters, you know, for an MF type trunk and everything, all the, you know, classes, you know, the types of trunks and where they were in there. It would be, I don't know how anybody would do it, but
it's definitely possible.
Yeah.
I think it's quotable. That's definitely something I got to quote in the future. Now, if I were to do such a thing, would this only be dialable then from my local area, or could I have someone from out of state dial the number that's provisioned? I would have to actually provision a number.
Well, you could actually have it in your own CO, but then you could use call forwarding from some other number, let's say, and forward to it, and then they can dial it. Or no, I guess you could build it on a regular telephone number and make it dialable. If you put it on a 7-digit telephone number.
Right. Well, maybe what I could do is I can put it on a special code and then have
it. Well, no, then it might not be dialable. But if you put it on a actual one telephone number and build that telephone number to go to this particular trunk.
Well, perhaps, I'm not sure if call forwarding works like this, but I
could. No, then don't do it on call forwarding. Just build that telephone number, not the forward, but to be a trunk-type number, and go on, and then it would be like any other telephone number. You'd pick an unassigned telephone number, and if you knew your way around, you would actually assign it, too. You know, go through whatever assignment systems and say, this number is now assigned, and there's a test number, and build it all up, you know, and although,
now
that would probably be terrorism and all that, there's high security, and they look at those switches stuff, you know, all the time.
Well, assuming I was successfully able to build this script and program the switch in such a way where a phone number directly drops you into something that's capable of receiving MF, what's the best way to go about doing it to where it will go unnoticed for the longest period of time? Any particular exchange I can stick it in, or any way I can do it in such a way where it'll no one even think to check, or they won't notice it?
They check codes and stuff, but AT&T might see it on a feature group C when they weren't supposed to be used, you know, some traffic on the trunk. So there's lots of ways, you know, that you could get caught.
But worst comes to worst, it just lasts for a few months and goes away.
Yeah, you never know, you know. It's impossible to predict.
Well, I just want to get it done just to prove that it can be done.
Yeah.
And the ideal situation.
Maybe have it just for one day.
Right. I mean, and of course, if you are sending things in straight MF, you will be able to dial those inward codes.
Yeah, if it's the right kind of incoming circuit of MF. I mean, the equal access MF actually blocks those now. So AT&T has gotten pretty smart knowing that a CO trunk shouldn't be dialing those using equal access signaling. But on a feature group C, they weren't checking 10 years ago.
Now, what exactly is a feature group C? I'm not familiar with that term.
That is an old AT&T trunk where you didn't have equal access, where it was just AT&T, or if you dial something that's not in your LATA but send it to an inter-LATA tandem within your LATA, a lot of times it'll default to one of those trunks. So they're kind of all-purpose, last-resort AT&T trunks.
They're
not used anymore.
But
they still have them in a lot of the offices, but because of that, you know, if you were, let's say, theoretically, you were using it, it would probably raise red flags all of, you know.
Well, like you said, even if it's for one day. So I set one up, and I go on the air one day, and I'd be like, everyone, you have to call this number. And 20,000 people call it. They all, you know, send calls all over the world, and it gets taken offline. I would feel that I really accomplished something there. Just telling people that this stuff, if you do it right, if you spend the time, and if you're really devoted, can happen. My next question is, because the MF signaling, even though it's very, very rare, still is in use in certain cases, any chance of seizing a trunk by in-band signaling using any kind of tonage at all? Basically, any way in the U.S. to blue box under modern conditions?
There might be. You'd have to go to a city that was 2600 to the 4E, to the toll switch, whatever it would be. I don't know if there's any even 2600s left. There theoretically could be, and there could be some old exchange that wasn't SS7 yet, some like non-Bell company, but where it would be, I don't know.
Assuming that there is no switches like that, also assuming that some services like the Zero Plus that do send the commands via MF, is there any kind of in-band signaling? Let's say I dial 0412-33, whatever, and then I go ahead and it starts ringing. Is it possible to break that ring since it was sent via MF?
No, but you might be able to, in some exchanges, drop off your OSPS, you know, and by flashing a certain way, down, up, you know, and do it with the all those MF, two-stage MF. But it would be, since they don't use operator services, I don't even know if that could be done.
And even if I were to do that, the only thing I could really do is get to a billing operator with a different number.
Yeah.
Not really a lot of success there. Although you are stepping in the right direction, it's not really, you know, getting you.
Yeah, it would be that, I mean, a guy in Denver did do it with TSPS. He even the, you know, told security about it. He said, look at your TSPS records and see who made some calls. And they were, it showed that they were made from the security office, which of course he wasn't in.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, my God, how'd you do that? You know?
This is all very, very interesting stuff. And again, I'm really glad to be talking to somebody who is such knowledgeable on this subject.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, you know, how, you know, we have a lot less control of the system than we used to, of course.
Yeah.
And, now it's all data, you know, on a different, you know, data link and out of band and all that.
Well, we definitely thank you for your time.
Another question I had. Someone talking? No? Another question I had. Do you think any of the old, besides the 121 and the zeros for the inward operators, any of the old codes are still in use anywhere? So let's say, assuming I'm crazy, I actually managed to break into the COA, I actually managed to program a switch for this number, and I actually have the point where I can call a number and get an analog trunk. What kind of cool things can I dial besides with inward operators? Do you think any of the old 600s exist for verified or any of the old 151s, the 191s, any of that stuff?
Probably not. Most of that stuff isn't needed anymore.
No.
And, you know, because even operators, the dial operators don't even connect you with inward anymore. Inward is not really, because that would just be the OSPS is all the same kind of systems. It doesn't really do any good if one operator can't get it, the other one can't. So it's kind of obsolete. So
right,
there
so.
Really isn't a lot. You could dial like 102 in a code, you know, and get the 1,000 cycle tone.
Yeah, what to do, you know.
I mean, it's not, to me, it wouldn't be worth spending time, you know, wanting to do it.
Yeah, well, maybe 20 years ago you felt different about that.
Yeah. You know, that's, you know, because things are worth, I mean, it would be, even if all you got is a 1,000 cycle tone, at least you can say, you know, you did what nobody else in the country has done.
Yeah, that's definitely for real. And one more thing I want to touch on is verification circuits. You mentioned how nowadays there's many safeguards, and even if you do manage to pop one, it's going to show up on the console with a switch, and it's going to get noticed real quick. Although there are dangers of doing it, any way possible that you know of to actually slip into one of those on modern equipment?
Not if you're not at the operator's board. In other words, those trunks are blocked from being able to be called, even if you knew what code OSPS uses. The operator, you know, they don't dial the code anymore. They push a button.
So even if you were able to get MF access, you still couldn't do that.
You wouldn't know what code to use because TSPS, even at the later parts, they had a verify key. And so you didn't know, the operator didn't know what code it was anymore. See, in the early days, they actually had to dial 600, let's say. That wasn't used in most of the country. That was just Miami.
Okay.
But let's say, you know, so that way thousands of operators had to know the code. Now none of them do.
And but there still is a code.
Yeah, but they are very, very careful in blocking it so that it would only work if you were in an operator's board. So even if you tried every one from the trunks, that, for one thing, it was blocked. But even if you had the trunks where you could, you know, get into a feature group C or something, it wouldn't work from those trunks. The chances are one in a million.
There we go, you know, time on your hands, with a shot.
Yeah, it's theoretically possible, but those mistakes are much harder to happen because, you know, there's program checks and everything to make sure of the class of service on those trunks, and it, you know, whereas before it was like wiring and cross connects and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it was much, much easier to overlook.
Well, as far as, what do you know about remobs? Have you heard that term before?
Very little. Yeah, I've heard most of it is mythical.
Well, we broke the myth about three shows ago, and we actually didn't have access to, quote, you know, hit, hit, wake, wake, the, to the system. But basically how this particular machine was supposed to work was you can type in any number in Verizon territory and be introduced into their line, unciphered crystal clear. And although, you know, you do expect them to have something like that for law enforcement purposes and whatnot, the question comes to mind then, if you're dialing into a switch, let's say, in Maryland, and you need to remob a number in Pennsylvania, that number isn't going to that local switch. So how does it authenticate to the switch in Pennsylvania and tell that switch, this is a remob in Maryland, I need to connect to this line? Because maybe I'm going about this all the wrong way, trying to break into the CO and reprogram their switch, which is probably insanely difficult just to be able to mob. What if I can just, you know, do a man-in-the-middle attack or just act like the send some kind of commands to the switch, acting like I'm another switch, requesting permission to listen to a line?
I think it's just line classification.
Yeah, I don't know how that all works.
What it boiled down to is basic line classification through the CO.
Yeah, I've never looked into that, so yeah, I don't know how that works.
It's quite possible that, like, through the Mac, you might be able to push through a ticket for it.
Well,
with very good, you know, with very good, you know, accreditation though for it, though, you know what I mean.
Well, we need to figure out.
It might be hard to pull off.
How remobs latch onto a phone number and a remote switch, and we need to figure out how we can act like we're that remob and request to attach onto another switch.
Yeah, I think it's
the my
class.
Name is Mohammed Afghara, and in the name of Allah, I would like a remob connection. It is the name of Allah, and if you do it for me, you'll have 70 versions in the afterlife. Please do, in the name of Allah.
Yeah,
if you want to come in and take some pictures, just send over to my friend Osama.
Yeah, they'll do it right away.
I'll be sending you comments, everybody.
Oh, well, I don't know.
You know, I think I'm out of questions.
Even
I said that about 45 minutes ago, I think I'm really out of questions.
I think we took enough of Joy Bubbles this time, anyway. Thank you very much for coming out, by the way, Joy
Bubbles.
Thank
you. Thank you. Yeah, it's always interesting to kind of revive some of this old history so that, you know, it won't die with me. It'll live on in some of these brave, intrepid hackers and crackers and people that are still curious.
You know, trust me when I say this, based on all the amounts of bogus information floating around, I have a hunch that the archive of this radio episode is going to be used as reference for many years to come.
For many years.
All that stuff floating around out there is not only, you know, incomplete, in most cases, inaccurate.
Yeah.
And being able to talk one-on-one, firsthand, with a person who's actually played with these systems many years ago is just the ultimate resource tool.
Sadly enough, even back in the 70s, there was even, like, a guy in Montana, he would come up with the most bogus, inaccurate stuff, and some of the freaks would call it 406-ing, the area code for Montana, when somebody was completely giving out bogus stuff. So it's been going on all too often.
Well, thank you for setting the record straight.
Yeah.
I mean, even though it was in your own era, though, I mean, you know, everything comes back from what you guys found.
Yeah, we were doing it. Of course, you know, I figure, you know, if I don't know, I just let you know I don't know. And,
yeah.
You know, that's because there's a whole lot I don't know. But what I did know, I, you know, knew from personal experience. I spent a lot of time with it, so.
And a lot of people, they think this new information, like people out there say, oh, RC Mac. Well, if you don't understand the switching systems from, like, years ago, when they first started everything, how are we going to understand what to do now? No one wants to learn what happened then to do now.
Yeah, like if they say, do you want wink-back signaling, you know, or something like that, you know, they still use that on MF trunks, you know, and those feature group Cs and everything.
No, I'm really glad to learn that because I'm going to start playing around a little bit.
Actually, I had one more question. Back then, was the telco so, like, acronymed as it is now? Was all the different departments, like, acronyms? Like, as in now we have, like, MLAC and RCMAC and, you know, like, RBOC.
That's a good question.
Yeah, there was a lot, like, CTI, Central Ticket Investigation, and, Although there was a lot that still had names, like we were in the Network Service Center in Denver, which used to be called the Service Bureau. So there was, I guess a lot of them did have names.
Wow. So you guys did have like a central ticket investigation back then?
Yeah, that would look, if a long distance call went to somebody denied the charges, they would call the distant party, CTI would, and say, do you know anybody in West Virginia at this number? No, I don't. Well, they've called you 1,817 times. You say you don't know them, sir?
Wow.
And stuff like that.
I still do that now. I got a call from an AT&T international operator wanting to know if anybody from England's been calling me because someone's been using credit cards to call me.
Wow.
So they probably still have that. I'm sure it's not called a ticket investigation. It might be.
Yeah, because we called in later. It was called MIC, and they were warning us not to accept calls. If MCI asked a question, MCI was different than MIC. This is when MCI was first coming up.
Right.
They got a telephone company memo, and MIC, I don't know what, it was basically the same function as CTI, but I don't know what the acronym stood for.
Right.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, I will definitely be recording this to CD-ROM tomorrow.
Yeah, just one more story, back then, they used to really be careful whether aligned with residents or business. They didn't want you trying to do business on a resident's phone. And there was a guy that decided to put in a dial a joke, but he didn't want to pay those 3 or 4 times residence rate. So he got this brilliant idea. He called up the business office. I want to put in a phone line. My name is Joque Diarra. My first name is Joque, J-O-K accent in E, Can you put the accent in there? No, we can't. Well, okay, just put it without. And so they had the J-O-K-E, the first name, and D-I-A-L-A is the last name. Then as the operator was processing the order, the business office, way down into it, she put in the directory listing and the notice. Sir, that comes out as dial a joke. That is my name. I'm from Syria, and that's my, you show ID. And suddenly he dropped his accent, swore a little bit, and hung up. So,
it was dial a joke?
Joque Diarra. And since they put the last name first, it would come out as D-I-A-L-A, Diarra, and then J-O-K-E, Joque, which also is joke, so. All kinds of ways of trying to freak the system,
Oh, yeah.
That was in Philadelphia in the mid-60s, sometime like the 60s that happened.
That's pretty cool.
So anyway, just thought I'd give you another example of social engineering in the 60s.
All that 1960 stuff, yet again, I found more things to talk about. Another article that I read on the internet some years ago explained how, under certain switching conditions, if two people called the same number at the exact same time, the number would pop, and then any future people who call that number, while the two original phones are off the hook, would be introduced into a conference bridge. And once the two original people hung up, the number would return to its original state. Any truth behind that? Do you have any examples?
What happened when they do it into a step, two people, if they were exactly at the same time, they'd steal battery from the call party. They would get nothing when they tried to pick up. And the third person that called in would actually get a busy, but the first two, I think it was, would actually conference. You could only get two together, and the call party would then be able to answer.
Wow.
Well, the article I read said that these people called a government number, and they orchestrated so the two called at the exact same time, and they were able to jack onto this number. And every time someone called this number after that, they would be entered into a three-way conference. And they continued to explain to the people who called that the number was currently unavailable because of a nuclear accident, at which point people would get freaked out, more and more people would call. And so towards the end of the call, they had 20 or 30 people, and they hung up the lines, and it reset back to normal and just started ringing the government office.
Now, what I heard is, I know you could do something like that. You could do a 555-1212, the ACD, and somehow be able to answer calls like that as if you were directory assistance.
Well, maybe that's the same story that was,
You could do it with directory assistance, and it wasn't where you had to do them at the same time, I think. I think it was some other method where the trunk would hang up or something, you know, hold up when you hung up on one. It might have been through that ACD thing, but I know that they did. There was some kind of nuclear thing that even made the papers locally or something.
Yeah, that's the article I'm referring to.
And and it was with directory assistance.
Oh, see, and that's, again, you know, article's only half true. Information got messed up over the years. That's another reason why I was going to talk to somebody who was actually there.
Yeah, and I was told how you do that with directory assistance, and I knew it then, and over the years, my senior memory has caught up with me, and I plain forgot it.
But I do know
it was actually done. And they did it in Rhode Island, too. They were doing something with, yeah, you could do it on root rate. Somebody was doing, I think, in Rhode Island on directory assistance. But it should actually be directory assistance. They were saying, you know, that number is disconnected. He couldn't pay his bill, you know, and then we're asking for some company or something.
And that person's daddy hung himself last night. How do we know? We're directory assistance. We know everything. We're information.
Yeah,
we're
the operator.
Yeah. Now, if you were to do that, would you only get select calls, or would you get the absolute next call or call directory assistance?
I think you'd just get any call that went to the trunk that you were holding up.
Ah, that's
slick. And somehow connected made that trunk come into you instead of directory assistance, and I can't remember how that was held up.
And the operator who's assigned to that trunk just sits there and doesn't get any calls for a while and wonders why.
I think they would still, on most trunks, they would still get calls, so they wouldn't know that this was happening.
That is so sweet. If only that stuff was still possible.
Yeah, this was a crossbar ACD, number 5 crossbar ACD that this was possible on.
Well, to what Harold was just saying about stuff being possible, if you actually got the knowledgeable on the asterisk, you could actually set the boxes up yourself just to have the system at home and just play with it like that.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be able to dial it words and stuff. I mean, once it hits VoIP, it gets filtered out.
You could set up your own whole entire network like that to where you're at home playing with your own system, have different boxes running for different numbers, and you could dial into it.
Well, that's true, but A, that takes the fun out of it, and B, I doubt that the asterisk system is anything like an actual DMS 100.
You can set the criteria like that.
What's that?
Said you can set the criteria like that because the criteria for asterisk is in Linux. And Linux, there's a variation out there of Linux called Plan 9. And that is usually what the new group, the language is for the switches.
Right now, I'm engaged in a project with a couple other freakers and everything where we're setting up different boxes on the asterisk for voicemail type prompts and things. These people, this and that, and these and that. So it's all going to be asterisk, and it's going to be set up on different numbers where you can dial in and play with the prompts.
Like for example, like a fake DATSU, where you can play with DATSU, is that actually breaking the law?
Yeah.
Dude, that's what we're setting up too.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to have that to where you can dial into it. All the functions will be the same. We're going to have a SAS unit. We're going to have everything.
Hacker Playland, Hacker Score games for the telephone, I love it.
I would actually like it if Asterisk could recognize just straight Plan 9, being that Plan 9 is, you know, a Bell Corp product, you know, from Bell Labs, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that would just be great.
I mean, this whole entire session was, oh my god, this is just invaluable. There's no way I can put a value on this information I just got today.
And another thing, too, is that, you know, you could build it yourself, and you wouldn't technically be breaking the law.
No.
As long as you still set the same switch criteria, you know, I mean, just break out a couple of manuals, you know, a couple of programming manuals for your DMS 100 or your 250s, you know, and then just plug that right into your asterisk box.
And so you're not breaking any laws because you're not actually breaking into a system.
Yeah.
So you sure learn how to do it if the opportunity arises.
Oh, trust me, we're working on it right now.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, you know, you're like a little bit of Sun Z, and I'll listen to it tomorrow. What project are you working on? Because, you know, I'm available for, you know, stuff like that.
Well, I mean, I've got an advanced programmer on it right now. So, you know, I'm not even really playing with it. He's showing I got the prompts and everything from different voice over IP networks. And so,
very nice.
Right.
it's going to be great if we can actually get the setup to where we can have like 100 users online just having voicemail wars.
Interesting.
Yeah. Who's paying the VoIP bill?
Yeah.
Dude, it's not that much.
Why don't you just stick it on freaking Fairwell dial-up? Isn't incoming a VoIP 3 cents a minute? Isn't it that much?
Yes, no, maybe. Well, make it a cheap subscription rate just to have more users.
They have cheaper rates for certain applications?
Oh, yes.
What's the cheapest you can get incoming VoIP for just for fucking around?
It just depends on what service. I mean, I'm constantly looking for different services, so... Once I find it, I'll find it.
You let me know, because I'm interested in VoIP going, too.
Oh, yeah. I wonder what it would be like back in the day when, with Joey Bubbles, if they actually had, like, asterisk PBX back then, you know?
I'd like to know. I mean, you know how our freezer community right now is so tight-knit that, I mean, everybody works with everybody.
Yeah.
What was their community like?
I mean, I think back then it was a lot more open. Would you say that to be true, Joey Bubbles?
Yeah, like, I always gave my regular name and address and everything. I had my address in the phone book, you know.
Yeah, I mean, nobody was worried about being owned back then, you know.
Yeah, that's the lamer mentality nowadays.
Well,
you have to be owned.
You know, the thing is, I mean, like this is honestly the reason why I think there's such secrecy and people try and hide their docs is because of, like, the laws now. You know, the laws are so vague. You know, back then there really wasn't much law. You know, I mean, all it was at the most was, you know, theft of phone services. You know, maybe a little toll fraud. You know, but a slap on the hand, you know, oh my gosh, go pick up around the block, you know, and that's it.
Nowadays, yeah. Just owning a freaking blue box is a federal offense.
Yeah.
Even though they don't work anymore.
I mean you have a red
box. I wonder, because there was a guy who used to let me hear the tones. He was, you know, long after it didn't work, he had one still. He died recently, a real good friend of mine. He's actually giving me money every week for my storytelling and all that.
Yeah.
But he actually had a real, honest-to-goodness blue box that he had built. He used to push it. He used to like to dial my old number in Memphis, the one where he first met me.
Yeah.
It's 901-452-2102.
Wow.
It was nice to hear those, you know, one button at a time type tones. Cause there's a exchange in New York, the 631-788. When it works, you can hear EMF going to intercept.
Fisher's Island.
See, I don't think it still works. I mean, it's broken again today. It was working a few days.
You can still hear that occasionally.
Only works sometimes.
That switch has been down frequently lately.
Yeah. Well, the Verizon network out here is really bad.
Yeah, it's going to reorder again. 631-788, like 8859 or something, or almost any number on there. Once it starts working again, you'll hear as it goes to intercept.
All right, that's the Fisher's Island, Stromberg, DCO.
People can be kind of weird about the scene. People want to keep themselves so secretive. I'll find honest-to-God freakers and hackers out here just by, like, I'm sitting at a payphone, pull out and try some tones on a box and be like, hey, what are you trying to do?
Oh, yeah, I've done that before.
And then I'll just run into them just pure accidentally. Bam.
I've confiscated red boxes at airports before. I have. Just walk up on them, tell them you're with security.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just, I meet the coolest people just, you know, trying to be myself at a phone or something, and they're like, oh, well, you're doing that wrong. I'm like, what? Okay. What? Show me how.
Yeah, it's like a guy I was telling him, I was testing the system, and he was, you know, some kind of a guy that was with a humanist organization or something, an atheist or something. And anyway, he kept saying, who are you trying to call? And that guy is having trouble dialing, and he won't let me help him. And they had no idea who I was or that I even knew how to use the phone. He was real confident that I was just, you know, poor old blind guy couldn't dial, you know.
Right.
You're now unmuted.
Dude, he'd never believe me.
Mm-hmm.
Little did he know that the original phone freaks were blind people.
Yeah.
You know, that whistled out the tones. That's why I was so, I was just so impressed when you gave us that demonstration.
I can't believe you can whistle tones like that.
You know.
Did it take lots of practice to be able to get to that point?
Not really. I just sort of heard, when I heard the noise on the long distance, and I kind of whistled along with the noise, just you know, for the sound of 2600 used to be in the background of any call, you know, it kind of, you know, even, you know, recordings of a little long distance, when I whistled along and it cut it off, and I noticed any time I went, like, puck, 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 and it cut the call off, you know.
Right.
And then I was taking a walk one time, I was about 8 years old, and we passed the payphone, the guy was talking and put the money in, I knew it was long distance, and I did it real loud. Goes, hello, hello. You know, and I cut him off, even though I was like 6 feet from the phone. I said, mommy, I think he got cut off or something, you know. She didn't know, yeah, but then I was,
wow.
That's years funny. Later, you know, and she whistled, you know, learned when she found out about my whistling and stuff, you cut that guy off, didn't you? Yeah.
You know, it really surprised me, too, because I'm on some little party lines around, and I met this girl that, that knows the clone up in Canada. I started talking to him, but I'd be punching DTMF tones, and she'd be like, hey, you just hit 17592, and I was like, what?
Yeah, like, there was a record called Hotline by Whiteheart, and at the beginning, there was touch tones, and I heard them and remembered them, and when I got home, I called it, put a one in front of it, called it, and a lady answered, hello, and I said, you know, this number was at the beginning of a record. It was a group. Have you ever heard of a group called Whiteheart? I think I have. My son is Mark Gerstmann. He's the leader of the band, you know. Said, well, he went, put your number at the beginning of the record. Well, that little rascal. And we talked an hour. Real nice lady.
Yeah, and this girl, she comes in handy, too. She's like, I'll help you with DTMF. And I'm like, really? She's got people's voicemail numbers for me, just like that. She's like, oh, here you go. He didn't know, but I was listening to the tone. I was like, wow.
Wow, that's pretty cool. She can just pick that stuff out with her own ears.
Yeah, dude, she's just right there, just boom, 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 boom. As soon as it hits, she knows right what it is.
That is so cool. So how long has the show been going on now?
I don't know, quite a while.
Quite a while. Are we going to wrap it up or what?
Yeah, we should wrap it up.
4 minutes?
Yeah,
let Joy Bubbles get back to us.
I used to like to say it's been a long 3 minutes, you know, because sometimes we'd talk on the call and it's, you know, it'd be a free call, but we'd be kidding and said, we better not talk more than about 3 minutes, you know, it costs too much. And then after 3 or 4 hours, you say, yeah, it's been a long 3 minutes, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, nowadays, I mean, with the unlimited local and long distance, you know, everything's starting to come down.
And if you'd have told me about this in the 70s, I'd have told you you're nuts and probably hung up on you. They're never going to have unlimited long distance.
Yeah, they do now.
I wouldn't have believed. Yeah, I've got
it's all because of the internet, too.
Yeah, I've got unlimited U.S. and Canada on this line, as a matter of fact. And
yeah.
My calling card to Australia, I'm obsessed with Australia, it's only 2.9 cents.
Oh, my.
What kind of cool stuff in Australia?
I've got a local voicemail over there, and I've got it listed, and I put ads in the paper wanting friends to talk to in Australia. And they leave their number, and I call them back, and I meet Australians that way.
Oh,
yeah. That's pretty neat.
And they send the Australian money to play with their bills. They're made of plastic.
Really?
And they have expressions like fairy floss and cotton candy. And they have two flush buttons on their toilets, the big flush and a little flush. You know.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, to save water and a slippery dip is like a slide, a playground slide.
Slippery dip.
Yeah, Central Australia is a half hour difference on the time zone instead of an hour. You know, so like if it's 10 o'clock at Brisbane, it'll be like 9:30 in Northern Territories or something.
You don't see that too much.
No.
I had a friend on the Chatham that lives in Australia, and he's kind of a little freaker himself, and we just changed some PBX codes the other day, and he's like, well, if you want, here's a country direct number to it. I was like, what? Thank you.
Cool stuff. Very, very cool stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd love to dial a local number here and then just get transferred to a PBX in Australia.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
Yeah, toll-free numbers, they have international toll-free. They begin with 011 and then 800 and then 8 digits, and they're free, and you get different countries depending on what you dial.
Yeah, I've been scanning out local exchanges here and finding the country direct numbers. It'd be like 313 da 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 da. I was like, wow, it's got Australia and Mexico. That's great.
And we got a plan with trying to box one of those older systems. Because, I mean, I set a goal for myself. Even though I missed it in the 80s, I want to be able to blue box at least once in my life.
Yeah.
Well, some of the country direct, there were honeypots and stuff, and you could still blue box on some of them.
They're really honeypots?
Yeah, I think there was the Brazil and Zimbabwe. You could buy, because I think Backbone and Tandem were blue box in Zimbabwe.
What do you mean? It actually works, but it logs you?
Yeah, it actually works.
I've tried
there was a bank over in, I think, Venezuela that we were trying to do a 2600 on.
I've tried breaking the China line, and they never did anything about it.
Yeah.
Well, China's kind of an advanced country. You gotta call some, like, shit country, like
Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Uruguay.
Somewhere where they're still on two cans and strings.
Right.
Somewhere where they still got, like, a 1A.
Once they approve the sound 10%, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You know, I just came to a conclusion. If we don't end this show soon, it's going to go on forever. No, maybe yes, huh?
What's that?
This show's going to go on forever, isn't it?
Yes. I'm going to wrap up the laser side of this. Thank you, Joey Bubbles, for coming on with us.
Yeah, I definitely can't thank you enough, man. I've really learned a lot on this.
Yeah,
I have also learned.
You really opened up the history book on this.
And then this recording is going to be saved for a very long time in pieces.
I'm going to mirror this place in about 10 different places.
I think any freak that has anything about him at all will have a copy of this show.
Well, they should. I mean, this is from the 50s on.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't, and that's 50 years of freaking.
Yeah, it is.
Right now, Switch now is now classifications from step by step and up downs. And, I mean, come on.
There's pretty much no topic we didn't cover. Nothing I can think of. I'm sure there's something, but I try to do a good job of covering everything here.
Back then, if you dropped the phone on your toe, you'd break your toe. Now you just break the phone.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we need to keep this open. Yeah, drop it now so we can have a part two also.
Yeah. There's always a part two.
The freaking and hacking thing will never close. I mean, it's always going to be an open subject.
Sometimes it gets a little slow. Like, you know, I think now is a slow point. In 97, there was a lot of activity and it was starting to slow down, but inevitably, and I think the internet broadband is picking it back up where you can download videos of how-tos and now radio shows are getting real popular on the internet. It's going to bring it back online again. So I definitely see the hack freak scene growing in the next few years.
I could never get bored with the freaking scene. I mean, I pick up my phone and I'll scan out 500-600 night, those numbers a night. And it's just when I find something, I'm like, wow.
There you go.
I mean, I didn't know about that before, and now I'm finding all sorts of cool stuff. You know, look.
Good stuff. Very, very good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really close. We're getting on topic again.
Okay, real quick. Anything anybody want to promote here on the laser before I shut it off?
I do have an announcement.
Okay.
HBX Networks Incorporated, my little side project, is going to be mentioned in a future spot. Tech TV, April 30th, 2004.
Nice.
I was told by Kevin Rose himself to expect a minimum of 20,000 hits to my website.
Jeez.
At which point it's most definitely going to crash, but, you know, hey, I'm going to try anyway.
Well, let me put a banner up.
April 30, 2004, Tech TV, HBX, be there.
Nice.
I have a small little announcement for Dazzy Direct. DazzyToday.tk, I'm looking for new articles on SARTs and SAS or any kind of remote access units. I'm going to just open up the page for a lot more content. So I'm accepting any kind of articles that make sense that are more than two words. I get a lot of submissions that are like two lines that say, I found this number. But if anybody has any kind of contribution, send it to datu_warrior@freaker.net.
Okay.
Nice.
Okay, I have one, actually. Just, I'm not sure if this is still around. Joy Bubbles, is your 612-953 still up?
It would be in the 952 area now. 953 would be.
Okay. So it's 612-952-5555?
You mean my old stories number.
Right.
No, now it's a new number. It's on laser. I had to take the other one out because I had budget cuts. When my friend died, it was giving me a subsidy. So Now it's 206-312-6363.
Oh, hold on. Let me write this down because I'll promote it.
Yeah, it's this week. It has about when I got a truck tire for Easter when I was 7 years old. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, Mother wasn't up to help me get it down the basement stairs. If I had just let go of it in time before it started rolling, I wouldn't have got that broken arm that I got.
Okay, it's 206.
312-6363.
Stories and stuff.
I will definitely I'll be adding that to my site for you.
Yeah, I changed it. It might be a terminally ill kid I've known, or a little girl that had talked for 2 years and talked one time when I was over there after we were playing one day. She had seen her father get shot and stopped talking. Stories like that.
Why? Okay, anything else anybody want to add before I shut the laser off?
Just have to add, sorry if I'm very loud in the recording.
Don't worry about it.
But the archive, as always, hackermedia.net/HAXOR.
All right.
And I should have a...
Hopefully he'll have 2, 3, and 4 up there by tomorrow.
I'd also like to thank audio.textfiles, Jason Scott, textfiles.com for archiving the show, as well as Kizzle.
Yep.
Thank you both.
Yeah. Dual mirroring, baby. All right, we're gonna go ahead and wrap this up. There may be some editing. We're gonna add the just for those that are listening to the laser. We're gonna add the bumper music in the front, and then the out music in the back for the internet copies. So just go there for that, and that'll be the only editing of this episode. Is just the bumper music and the. Outer music, and that's it. All right, thanks for listening. We're going to be recording again tomorrow, so make sure you check the directory tomorrow. Then the directory number again, of course, is 206-888-5819. All right, thanks. Have a good night.
You have been listening to I Hate Mr. Law by Tree.
This is Hairball, and you have the Hacks or Laser Show.